Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We're pleased to be with you this morning. As I assume many of you who are here assembled are aware, we have one case on the oral argument calendar, a substantial case, the United States versus Mikhail and Katamovas. Counsel, you've been given 60 minutes. We will expect you to be judicious in your use of time. I understand that you're splitting it 3 and 3. Is that correct, Mr. Coleman?
Yes, 30 and 30.
I'm sorry, 30 and 30.
Yes. Although I represent Mr. Katamovas, who's number two in our planning, we decided I would go first. I guess I'll just do a quick summary of how we plan to divide this. We're going to obviously address all seven issues in the court's order. We would like to add one issue if we have time. We'll do our best. I am going to do the recusal issue, Mr. Mikhail's testimony, Mr. Mikhail's note, the future danger jury instruction, and I'm going to try to fit in that extra issue, which is our statutory construction of Section 1203. Mr. Tanaka is going to argue the Batson issue, Mr. Mikhail's competency, and the videos. And I'll start with the recusal issue, and I'd like to start as to that issue with advisory opinion number 84. And I'm starting there because the government has ignored it completely in its brief. That opinion makes it clear that if a federal judge explores any relationship with a law firm, no matter how tentative or preliminary, he has a duty to recuse. And the opinion itself also says that a law firm is not simply a private law firm or it's any potential employer.
Counsel, let me ask you this. This is obviously an important issue, but as I look at this, the judge, if I recall correctly, indicated during a status conference toward the very end of the guilt phase of the trial, that because there's some public discussion, that he wanted the parties to know that approximately 2 weeks before, he had been contacted by a search committee and asked to submit his name because he had previously made it known that after this trial, he was going to be retiring from the bench. He was going to do ADR. At that time, nobody made any motions. Nobody said anything. And it turns out when the motion was made on, I think, January 20th the next year, he immediately indicated he had withdrawn his name. He had never spoken with anybody at the Department of Justice. He had never spoken with anybody at the White House. He just had this contact by the search committee. So the advisory opinion is nice. It talks about a law firm. But in this case, he wasn't talking about with any principals. He was talking with a search committee. Isn't that different, particularly in this case when he said he was going to work for free, basically, because he already had his federal pension? He made no contact with the prosecuting authorities at all. Why isn't this more like a judge at, say, the district court trying to get out of the court of appeal or something like that?
Well, there's obviously a lot there, Your Honor.
I know. I appreciate that.
And I'm going to try to address as many of those points as possible. First, with respect to the record, at that initial, it was December 28th, mm-hmm. And it was in a holiday break towards the end of the guilt phase. Mm-hmm. And what he said is that a search committee had asked if he would let his name be considered. Mm-hmm. He actually never even said that he said yes, although the implication is that mm-hmm. he did say yes. Now, after that date, he then submitted a formal application with the committee. And I think, as Your Honors know, these are not because you've been through the process. These are not applications where you sign one page and say, yeah, I'm interested in the job. I mean, these applications go on for pages and pages, requiring an extensive amount of material about your background. This is not a simple little task. So that is taking, not only does that show how much he wanted the job, but it also takes it to another level of, this isn't just someone considering loosely a name. This is a formal application. He then, after, which he didn't disclose, he interviewed with the local screening committee, he later identifies it.
Do we know what the local screening committee was? This is a committee that's set up by, at the time, would have been Senators Feinstein and Boxer. Is that correct?
We don't know. That's
the tradition today.
That would be the tradition. And we don't know from the record. Mm-hmm. It's not clear.
And usually it's a bipartisan committee.
You know, Your Honors probably know better than I have because I haven't been through it. I know that typically if there are two Democrats that are, for example, in California, and that time it was the Bush administration, I know that they divided up between one senator takes two of the districts in California, another senator takes the other two districts, and I don't know whether the committee is comprised of both Republicans and Democrats. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, but it is the local screening committee that's passing the names on, he said, to the Department of Justice, and he then later said that his application...
Well, usually I think the process is that the committee will pass the names on to the senators who have a shot at doing it. There's a political element to all of this, and then I think the senators will forward names to the White House.
That may be, but however the route it was, he did say that his application did get passed on to D.C.
What's the danger? What is it that you're worried about? What is it that you think? What incentives do you think Judge Tabrisian has that might prejudice your client?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's the appearance of bias. That's the standard.
Okay, but who is it that he would be appealing to? Who is he going to shade an evidentiary ruling? This is at the end of the trial. This is you've had everything except for Mikhail's 3 days of testimony.
And then that's the critical part of the case.
Right. But you've got if you've got an evidentiary ruling. Who is Tabrisian appealing to if you think he's shading his evidentiary rulings?
He's appealing to, although I don't think that that's required, he's appealing to his potentially future office that he's going to leak.
Yeah, give me a name, give me an office, give me a city.
Okay. He is appealing to the United States Attorney's Office to the Central District of California.
Why? They don't appoint him. They can't appoint him. They have no control over this whatsoever.
Let's say he pulls the plug on the trial. He says, you know what, Mr. Katimovas, you deserved a new trial based on the Ninth Circuit precedent, binding precedent says you get a new trial. I'm giving you a new trial. He then, a month later, has to walk into that office, and he has to lead that office.
Right. You're arguing that the conflict is the danger if he got appointed, that he would then have difficulty managing the office. That's very different from saying that he's appealing to, let's say, White House Counsel's office or to the Office of Legal Policy or the EOUSA office.
He's appealing to that
justice
too.
I mean, in order to get appointed.
That's the appearance also, is that the people who are making the decision are watching this huge case. I mean, that's the appearance. That when we're talking about a reasonable observer, what the Supreme Court said in Liljeburg is that it's a suspicious observer. It's one who's going to look at what a judge does suspiciously. We're not going to give him all the benefits of the doubts. And we have all these types of conflicts.
So your principal concern is that if he got appointed, that he would shade these things in order to be able to better manage one or two of the, whatever it is, 200 AUSAs in the Central District.
Well, I don't know if I would say that's the principal, but that's certainly one of the concerns. The other concern is, would he be making rulings that would favor his potential future employer, help him get this position?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to drill down to, because that's where I thought you were going.
Well, we are going
there.
It's
the question, because in the law firm, you've got the question of hiring and salary. The salary's off the table here. The question is, can he get the job?
Right.
Now, the U.S. Attorney's Office has nothing to do with that.
Well,
so you've got the concern is going to be people in Washington D.C.
That's correct.
So if he's worried about what getting through to White House Counsel's office or somebody in let's say the Attorney General's office, then wouldn't a judge have an obligation to recuse himself from all cases involving the United States?
Well,
and what about AEDPA cases in which somebody might say, oh no, the judge is granting habeas. Wouldn't a judge have to recuse himself in anything that might be sensitive to somebody making the appointment?
Well, AEDPA may be different, a state case where...
Right, but if they thought that you were soft on crime because you granted habeas, then you might not get the appointment. Wouldn't that be a danger?
Well, I think the danger that the advisor opinion is talking about is the danger of the potential future employer. I mean,
counsel, with respect, I want to go back to what my colleague mentioned a minute ago, and that's the practicality of this. The search committee, at least during the time of the George W. Bush administration, which this was, the way it worked was that the committee would review a number of people and then ultimately make recommendations. According to what the judge said in January after you made your motion, was that no one in the DOJ had talked to him, nobody in the White House had talked to him. In short, this was with this local committee that was going to make a recommendation to a senator and that may or may not have even been considered by the White House. So you get back to the situation that my colleague's pointing out. How could any judge sitting in a case where the United States was involved rule in any way for a defendant if that was the real test here. The truth is, this is at the end of this guilt phase. I forget how many witnesses there are at that point. I know overall there were like 100 witnesses in both aspects of the trial. All kinds of testimony, all kinds of everything going on, and you're at the very end of it, and here's something that at the very best is really speculative. So I know you feel that this is an appearance of evil, if you will. What's your best case? And don't give me the one from the D.C. circuit. That's not a D.C. circuit. It's a local. It's like a state intermediary. It's like the appellate division of the Superior Court. So don't give me that one. Tell me a case other than and then just the one in the Seventh Circuit, which is very different. Is there any case from our circuit that comes anywhere close to the facts of this particular matter?
No. I mean, there's no Ninth Circuit. I don't think there's any other circuit, federal circuit precedent on this issue one way or the other. With this particular scenario.
And this is an abuse of discretion standard, is it not?
Well, we have a dispute about that, but even if the court says it's an abuse of discretion standard, mm-hmm. what this court has recently articulated in its in-bank cases as to what that standard means is the very first step is the judge has to identify the relevant legal standard. In this case, Judge Tavrisian, he never even identified the legal standard. He never cited Section 455. He never mentioned what the standard was. He didn't mention Advisory Opinion Number 84 or any of the relevant cases. He simply said, I don't think I would have been biased. And then there were all these other judges who either before they were judges were prosecutors or afterwards worked for the executive branch. That's not the standard. So, I don't think the abuse...
Yeah, but all of those cases go to the point that Judge Smith and I were pressing you on. That is that anybody who wanted, let's say, promotion, let's call it a promotion from the district court to the court of appeals, is in effect auditioning as they're a district judge. They may have to recuse themselves not only from all cases involving the United States, but that any case that any political actor in Washington, D.C. might be concerned over, which would include, for example, AEDPA cases. Well, and if that's the case, how does a judge possibly do that? He's disclosed the fact. If he had owned stock in a company that was affected by this under 455B, which is the mandatory recusal, he can actually divest himself of the stock in order to do it. Once he is challenged, he immediately withdraws. He's effectively divested himself of the stock once there's an objection. But the objection's not raised until really late.
Well, okay. His withdrawing his application is further evidence that shows an appearance of bias because any observer could believe that he would hold it against the defense.
No, it didn't occur to the trial counsel to ask him to recuse himself until much, much later when things obviously ran against them.
The practicalities of the situation, I think, have to be considered. He doesn't tell them that he submitted a formal application. He doesn't tell them that they've been interviewed. When they find out he's been the front runner, recusal motions are an extraordinarily sensitive area. I've never filed one in my entire career, and I've been doing this for almost 25 years. I wouldn't want to file a recusal motion against the three judges that are going to be hearing this appeal.
Yeah, hope you won't.
What's that?
I'm just kidding.
I know. I mean,
it's coming a little late, Mr. Coleman, if you're thinking about that now.
It would be late. But these are no lawyer wants to do it. And that's a good thing. And to encourage that the second he said anything, before they did any factual investigation or legal research to determine the propriety of a recusal motion, to encourage them that the first second a judge says anything, you have to go ahead and file a recusal motion.
But it was quite a while, right? I mean, are you arguing that it's not untimely because it took that long to do the research?
Well, let me first say this, and then I'll directly respond to that question. The government concedes that we have a preserved recusal motion as to the penalty phase. So at the very least, they've made that concession. It may not have taken the full...
I'm not sure they've agreed that it's timely. They agree you have a motion that's preserved, but whether it's timely or not as to the penalty phase, I'm not sure they've conceded that.
Well, the district judge twice said your arguments are preserved for appeal, said it twice. The government never objected to that. To get to Your Honor's question about the 30 days, did it take 30 days to do the legal research? It was approximately 30 days before they filed the motion. I mean, it takes some time to do the legal research. I think the court is indicating this is, it's an interesting issue. It's not something that maybe, you know, you can just whip off in 1 or 2 days.
Could it satisfy a plain error standard?
Well, we maintain the government has conceded that plain error doesn't apply, at least as to the penalty phase.
Okay, well, let's just say hypothetically that because it wasn't objected to at that particular point, that it's plain error review. If it were, and that we're not saying for sure it is, but if it were, what's the clear law that would be violated under the clear under the plain error standard?
Well, we would submit advisory opinion number 84.
That's your best authority.
I think it is, and it's okay. that's the committee on the code of conduct for the federal judiciary.
Okay, and in this case, let me ask you, counsel, what rulings that the judge made after he was contacted by the committee do you believe were directly affected by his application?
Well, I don't believe we have to show that, but I do believe.
I know, I'm just asking you.
Here are important rulings.
Yeah.
Number one, which I'll get to momentarily, his denial of Mr. Katimovas' motion for a new trial after and a mistrial after Mr. Mikkel refused to be cross-examined. That was during this period.
That was after he disclosed it, right?
It was between December 28th and then the January 29th.
Right. So I'm saying, Mikkel's testimony that was later struck because he refused to be cross-examined occurred after he had disclosed this conflict, in quotes.
Right.
Is that right?
But it's our position that he didn't give full disclosure. It was a misleading, limited disclosure. He said, the only thing he said, he never mentioned that he had applied. He never mentioned that he had interviewed. He just gave this little snippet that someone asked that my name be considered. He never even said, and I said yes, but he said, who knows what will come of it.
That's not the way I read the record. I think I've actually got some of it here. I think he said much more than that. Let's see.
I have it right here, Your Honor.
Okay.
Whether anything comes of it, I don't know. Well, if he had decided not to apply, there wouldn't anything come of it, would there?
I agree. The implication is that he said yes, but he never even says he said yes, but that's the implication.
I'm not doing it for any financial gain, but I took the position that I would do it for $1 a year. I haven't been contacted by the administration. I haven't been contacted by anybody in Washington. It's December 28th.
Right.
They make recommendations and they ask me to submit my name. Whether anything, I mean, that's the implication is obviously he didn't tell them no.
I agree. That's the implication. But he doesn't say I applied for the position. I submitted that enormous application.
What's the difference, though?
What's the difference?
If he gives more detail, given what my colleague had just mentioned, it's clear that he was going to go forward and see what happened. So would he have to give you a copy of the application? I mean, what difference does it make? You were on notice that the judge in this trial had been contacted by the local committee, asked to submit his application. He indicated by virtue of, you know, he was going to do it for $1 a year, et cetera, that he was going to do that. What more do you have to know?
Well, you again have to come from the point of a lawyer in the middle of a death penalty case. I've got to make a decision about whether I'm going to file a motion to recuse the judge that's presiding over this case. I'm not really sure what it is that he's telling me.
Counsel, you've got very little to lose here. There's no question as to the guilt of your clients. That's not in dispute. It's not in dispute here. It really wasn't in dispute there, especially at the end of the government's case. The only thing you're going to do is your client is in jeopardy because Mikkel's going to take the stand. That's not a good thing to think about. Other than that, you're off to the penalty phase.
And that's a huge burden. And I've got to decide whether, when my client's very life is on the line, am I going to file a motion to recuse the judge who's going to be presiding over the penalty phase of the trial? I mean, to think that the second that he said the little bit on December 28th, that all of a sudden, while they're figuring out how they're going to deal with Mikkel's testimony, figuring out, you know, all their penalty phase evidence, because they're, you know, assuming they're going to get a guilt verdict, all these things they've got to do, jury instructions, they're still cross-examining witnesses, closing arguments, and they're trying to get witnesses from Europe over to the United States. They're doing all these things. The judge drops this bomb, but it's not clear what the bomb is.
Right. But again, what have you got to lose? I understand the sensitivity of making a recusal motion, and we see a lot of frivolous recusal motions in our court. But your client has got nothing to lose here by filing a recusal motion.
All right. Well, At this point, I first want to say it was already sensitive between the defense attorneys and the judge. The judge had called in one of the defense attorneys and his doctor because the defense attorney had an accident over the weekend, and he actually brought the doctor in to try to confirm whether or not he was drinking alcohol over the weekend.
Which seems like a legitimate concern for a district court who's responsible for managing a trial where a defendant is entitled to two counsel. And if one of them is not functioning as counsel and the district court knows it, then it may be a plain error problem.
Well, I mean, it was purely speculation. I mean, there was no indication that this lawyer had any alcohol problem or anything like that. This was total speculation that he was drunk or doing something inappropriate, and that's why he fell down the stairs.
Let me go back to something we talked about earlier. You were concerned about what the district judge didn't tell you on December 28th. And yet the next thing that happened in this particular aspect of it was that you moved to recuse him. What new information did you receive from the judge between December 28th and January 20th that led you to file this motion on January 20th?
It wasn't from the judge. It was from newspapers. That was
okay.
In the motion, it says newspapers reported that he was the front runner for the position.
Okay, and when did that occur?
I can tell you, but it's not in the record.
Because I understand.
I believe it was January 18th or 19th.
Okay, so 2 days after you read that in the paper, you filed it.
I need to correct the court. The motion wasn't on January 20th, and this hurts me. It was on January 29th. That's when they filed it.
29th, okay, so January 29th. So, and there was no research done before, and I know this is also off the record. There was no research done between December 28th and, January 19th? 18th?
That,
is that right?
That I don't know. The only reason why I know about the article is because I looked on Google. I looked up when the article came out.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what research was done or not done. I just know that if I'm a lawyer and I need to file a recusal motion against the judge who's presiding over my client's death penalty trial, that I'm going to take some time to figure out whether the motion has legs before I even think about filing it.
And this article, and I realize this is a little off the record, but I'm trying to understand the flavor of this, what was going on here. What was it that the article said that led anybody to believe he was the, in quotes, front runner? Had somebody on the committee said that's what he was? And if so, on what basis?
And that I don't remember the article that well. I just remember I wanted to look up again when the date was of the article. But I think it says to the effect of he was the front runner. But I don't
was
remember.
Was it a front runner?
I don't remember whether it was D or A. I can find out.
What's interesting
out.
Here is that we have no idea who leaked this to the press. What Judge Tavrisian says on the hearing on January 30th is, I haven't been contacted by the White House. I haven't been contacted by the Department of Justice. I have now reached out to the White House and told them that I'm withdrawing my application. I've indicated that to the search committee. So if somebody was trying to manipulate the White House, for example, by leaking a list that perhaps one of the senators favored, so it was a political move. We were talking to each other through the newspapers, which is frequently done. Tavrisian may not have had anything to do with that. It may not have even been true. But at that point, you come in and say, okay, now we're concerned, and boom, he's out. He withdraws immediately.
Correct. And the withdrawal?
It's sort of like the stock situation, the 455B.
I don't think it is. I mean, the withdrawal does not. We've cited some cases where the appearance is that
Your position is it doesn't cure the errors between mid-December and mid-January.
It certainly doesn't cure those.
And I don't know what those errors are.
That was the denial of the mistrial motion,
right?
Because of Mikkel's testimony.
Let's move to those. Maybe okay. We should move to those issues because
that
would bolster your case for recusal here,
okay.
and they stand on their own as
okay.
well.
And just to wrap this up, you have given us your very best argument for why the failure of the judge to recuse himself immediately when he talked to you in a status conference on December 28th, the whole guilt phase of the trial should have been thrown out. There should have been a mistrial and start all over again. Is that your position?
Well, if the judge had recused himself and what could have been done if he had done it right away, that may have been a different story if he had done so. At this point, it's our position that, yes, the error should not be deemed harmless. I mean, if the court just finds it a forfeiture.
Okay, if it's not harmless, then what's the result? Tell me what, if you'd been the judge, given your reading of the law of recusal, what should he have done at that point?
Well, he never should have sought the position.
I understand that. He didn't seek it. They sought him. He then applied. But the reality is he did. So given that fact, what should have been done? Should there have been a mistrial? Is that your position?
Well, declare a mistrial, or conceivably, maybe he could have gotten another judge to replace him. It would have been very difficult given the circumstances, but maybe that would have been a possibility.
Basically, as far as you're concerned, this, even though there's no authority directly except for your advisory opinion, the whole thing just gets blown up, notwithstanding all the witnesses on everything else. No evidence you can give to me of what specifically was caused, what rulings, for example, that were wrong from your perspective were caused by this response to the committee.
I want to get to that ruling,
but
I do want to say this. I mean, we've taken a position that it amounted to a due process violation. If the court disagrees and it's just a 455 violation, there is a harmless error component to that. Now, the court could say we've made the argument that the error is not harmless as to the guilt phase. But the court could say the error was harmless as to the guilt phase, but it wasn't harmless as to the penalty phase. And the court could reverse on the penalty and not on the convictions. I don't know if that answers Your Honor's question, but that is a alternative where a court could say the whole case isn't blown up.
So how does harmless error work here? Because in Liljeburg, I mean, I would assume the error would come from the doubt that the public might have or the question of fairness. And if that's a question and that's why there is an error, then how is it ever harmless?
Well, the only criminal cases that have found similar recusal-type violations have found that the error was not harmless. And I agree that I think we have a strong argument that the error is not harmless. But the court, I guess, could conceivably say, given the length of the trial, all the different burdens on both of the parties, I think that's like one of the first Liljeburg factors, given that the public's confidence in the outcome of the guilt phase perhaps isn't so seriously undermined as it would be to the penalty phase, that the court could say, and I'm not saying that it should, but it could say that the error is harmless as to the guilt based on those Liljeburg factors, but as to the penalty, it's a different story, and it's not harmless as to the penalty.
Let me ask you one other element. I apologize for dwelling on this, but this is an important one, at least to me. You got Judge X, district court judge. He's contacted by a local search committee saying, there's an opening in the Court of Appeals. We think you'd be great. We'd like you to apply. He's ruling. He knows that the executive branch is pretty conservative. They're not going to like any rulings like that. In that situation, does the judge have to recuse him or herself?
No.
Why not?
Well, number one, advisory opinion number 84 doesn't apply.
Why not?
Because that's just for post-judicial employment after you retire. This is just continuing on to be a judge. In addition,
Is that the key element from your perspective, that he's going to retire?
And he's going to no longer be a judge, yes.
Why is that?
That's what the opinion says.
No, I understand, but why should that make a difference in terms of the fairness of the trial and whether or not there should be a recusal? Let's assume he's going to continue. Say this judge wasn't going to retire. He simply had this opportunity. What's the difference between that and his being asked by the local committee to put in his name for consideration as a Court of Appeals judge?
Well, I think the difference here, and I don't think this court has to determine every single federal executive branch position, but the difference here is that the very office that's litigating the case in front of him, that's the difference. I mean, when you're applying to become a judge, you're not making decisions on a case where the very office that that you're applying to,
but the same people that vet U.S. attorneys also vet judges. It's the Office of Legal Policy and the White House Counsel. The same people, same interest in whether or not they like the rulings of the judge and whether he or she is of a particular approach. So I don't see what the difference is.
Well, we've said that there's more. We think that sort of currying favor with those types of people is one factor. I've said that another factor is that he's going to step in and lead this very office that's prosecuting the case in front of him. He has a reputation in that particular office. Those are separate factors.
Do you concede, counsel, that, as my colleague mentioned, that the local office of the U.S. attorney doesn't make this decision? It's going to be made in Washington primarily based on political considerations. Do you agree with that?
The ultimate decision, yes. But yeah. I'm sure that the people in the local office have a say. I mean, I'm sure that
they do.
Well, I would think that they would. We don't want that person. That person would not lead this office well, or we don't like. I mean, I would think
who would they tell that to? The senator?
either the senator or if they have direct connections to Washington, D.C. I think that goes on a fair amount.
That would be kind of dumb, wouldn't it, if you thought your future boss was, you're going to rag on the boss?
Well, I mean, these things get very political. I mean, there's a lot.
It is political. That's the point.
Exactly.
It is political. And I'm trying to find out what's the difference between the postulate that I gave you of the district judge that wants to be a court of appeals judge and the district judge that wants to be a U.S. attorney. Admittedly, there's a prosecution element, but that's not what's really the question here. It's a political decision based upon how the judge-to-be or the prosecutor-to-be is perceived as dealing with, in this case, defendants.
Right. Well, it's also, we said this, and I think this comes out a little bit in the Williams case, the recent Supreme Court decision on recusal. He would be interested in the reputation of that office. I mean, if that office is a stellar office, it enhances his reputation. A coach would rather coach the New England Patriots than the Cleveland Browns. If this is, you know, a premier office in the country and he's going to lead it, that's a feather in his cap. It's something more that he's interested in. I just think it's a different, the opinion itself doesn't talk about judicial elevation. It talks about post-retirement plans with a different employer. And I think there are differences, and that's why the opinion is focused on this type of situation, not the judicial elevation situation.
Okay.
I'm over already.
I'd like you to go ahead.
Okay. With respect to Mr. McKell's testimony, we've submitted a lengthy 28J, and I apologize for that, in response to the court's order. Whether this court goes the Sixth Amendment route or the Fifth Amendment route, the result is the same. This court has held that unreliable Bruton evidence is inadmissible or shouldn't be considered at a penalty phase under the Due Process Clause. That's exactly what we have here. We have totally unreliable Bruton evidence from a mentally ill co-defendant.
Can you talk about what was so inflammatory about it that it satisfies the Bruton and too late standard?
Well, he confesses that he and Mr. Tatamovis are these international money launderers that have been doing this. Mr. Tatamovis has this access to million-dollar jewels that they then go and he has contacts in Turkey and all throughout the world that they then go and sell the jewelry, launder the money, that they're these sophisticated criminal masterminds. And that's really the government's theory of the case from the beginning, that both of these two are criminal masterminds that masterminded this entire scheme. The defense for penalty was Mr. Katimovas is not a criminal mastermind. He has no prior record. He wasn't the mastermind behind this. He's no more culpable than the other co-defendants who didn't get the death penalty. But McKell's testimony has him as this, cunning, sophisticated extortionist and money launderer that puts the mitigation in an entirely different light. So that is really the incriminatory aspect of the testimony that really hampers the penalty.
I mean, being a money launderer, though, is probably not going to get you the death penalty, right? I mean, it's not what was really at issue in the guilt phase or much in the penalty phase.
Well, I think it does in the sense that besides undermining his mitigation, that he has no prior record, hasn't committed other criminal conduct.
But it wasn't inconsistent with that anyway, right? Isn't it that he was money laundering with McKell? So to the extent the defense was, I didn't do any criminal activity before I was involved with McKell, that's still true?
Well, the question is, well, how did Mr. Katimovas get a $1.2 million emerald that McKell wasn't involved in that? Supposedly that was Mr. Katimovas's emerald. I mean, presumably he didn't get it, selling aquariums.
He just didn't do it in Lithuania. That's what your evidence would have shown if we credited the letter from.
Yes. But it also goes as far as what was really important at the penalty phase is a main theme of the government's penalty is these cunning criminal masterminds are a future danger. They're are not going to be housed safe. We won't be able to house them safely in the future. They're a danger to other people in the future. The position that he's not a criminal mastermind, he's not on this cunning level that maybe Mr. McKell was, that he can be safely managed and not constitute a future danger, that's really where his testimony totally undercut the mitigation.
Counsel, I've looked at the cases, and I think that the case may be distinguishable from Bruton and Richardson versus Marsh. too late seems to help you a bit until you get to the harmlessness. I read all 3 days of Mikkel's testimony. It's a weird circus. It is really strange stuff. And one thing I did is I took a highlighter and I highlighted every time Katimovas' name appeared in Mikkel's testimony. There isn't a whole lot there. There's really not very much there. Oh, there's a couple of things that he might corroborate the government's testimony on, the ties, but none of that was really in dispute anyway. Overwhelming evidence on that. And we said in too late that harmlessness applies, and in too late, even though we found that there was a Bruton problem, we said there was overwhelming evidence, so it didn't do any damage. What's the problem here?
Again, I'm going to penalty. What? I'm going to focus on the penalty. I think that Mr. Katimovas' name is mentioned a fair amount. I mean, I don't want to quibble about how often it's mentioned, but I mean, there are lots of things. He's talking about how they extorted this guy named Armin, that.
Mr. Coleman, they brutally murdered 5 people in Los Angeles.
I understand.
Whether they may or may not have done something to somebody in Turkey or Cyprus just seems small potatoes compared with the detail that the jury has been given from co-conspirators, the solid evidence that the government had that corroborated everything they did. You're saying that if they hadn't had if they hadn't had some stray statement that they were told to ignore about having hurt somebody in Turkey or Cyprus, that the jury would have come back without a death penalty in this case?
Well, I mean, as to the every death penalty case, the facts are bad and they're egregious. Krylov, on the same facts, did not get the death penalty, co-defendant Petro Krylov. He wasn't tainted and saddled with, as you said, a circus, with Mr. Mikkel getting up there and saying all these things that reflected a tremendous lack of remorse. I mean, he said, awful things about the victims. It was the jury must have sat there and looked at this and just been disgusted. And then he won't be cross-examined, and he walks off the bench, and he's gone for the rest of the trial. I mean, besides the actual things he says, the tone and tenor of what he says, it's virtually impossible to put on a mitigation at that point.
From your client's perspective, Mr. Tanaka may have a different problem here, but from your client's perspective, Mikkel creating a circus around himself may put some distance between him and Katimovas. This may have actually worked to your benefit, if there was any benefit to be had.
And the problem is it couldn't because of the instruction not to consider the testimony, the defense could not argue that. The defense could not even make that argument at penalty.
But if you're concerned that the jury can't unsee what it saw, then you don't really have to worry about that.
Well, except for the fact that the government linked the two together the entire time. I mean, they were like, they were the masterminds. They did this. They did that. I mean, they were essentially made one, even though Mr. Katimovas had an entirely different picture or set up with these escapes and everything like that. And I did want to talk about the Mikkel note. But the defense could not even argue that his testimony, Mr. Katimovas didn't say these types of things, didn't do these things that lacked remorse. They couldn't make that argument. Because the testimony, they weren't allowed to address it. So it's our position that, I mean, the standard is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. When you have an error of this magnitude, this is 3 days of testimony. It's not just some stray mention of a defendant's out-of-court statement. I mean, it seems to me that in a death penalty case, that the court could comfortably say that the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
What specifically did Mikkel say about your client in that 3-day ramble that you believe is fatal to the government's position? Why should you win on this issue?
I think the most important aspects are that the impression of the testimony is that he's a criminal mastermind that engages in international money.
I understand the envelope you're talking about, but I'm talking about what specifically did Mikkel say that you feel was so awful about what he said about your client that you're entitled to this particular remedy?
That he had a $1.2 million emerald that they sold, and I believe that one was sold in London, and then laundered the proceeds from that back to the United States.
But again, as my colleague mentioned, I mean, these are things that happened outside the country, had nothing to do with the murders, and that's really the issue here, is it not? It's not so much the other things, it's the murders.
I disagree. I mean, in a penalty phase, the issues are often
sure.
the other things, and that's the problem we have here, is that his
mitigation... Mikhail's testimony was in the guilt phase, was it not? They got stricken? That's what you're talking about,
yes.
isn't it? So what does this have to do with the penalty phase? This is in the guilt phase.
We've said that the error wasn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, it's the guilt phase, but we've focused on the penalty phase. And once the testimony was given, whether it was given in the guilt or the penalty, the remedy of striking it isn't sufficient. That's what the Supreme Court has said.
So the fact that they had this diamond sale in Turkey or wherever it was is enough to blow up the whole trial, including the penalty phase, even though this occurred in the guilt phase, and that's your best argument for the terrible thing that he said about your client?
Well, I'm not talking about blowing up the whole trial, but I'm blowing up the penalty, just the penalty phase.
Okay.
Okay, that's... I'm trying to focus on the penalty phase.
Even though the actual statements that you take offense to occurred in the guilt phase.
Yes. That.
In other words, it's so bad, it's so unremovable that it just tainted the whole balance of the trial.
Of the penalty phase, yes.
Okay.
I don't know whether the court will...
I'm going to allow you some additional time. We have some interest in the issue, so okay. you may proceed. I'm not going to let you run on all day, but...
All right, okay. Yeah. I'll move to the Mikhail note then, since I guess it's a little bit related. The note should not have come in against Mr. Katimovas as a co-conspirator statement. Our best authority on that, I believe, is Luthwak versus United States, which is a Supreme Court opinion, and United States versus Silverman, which is a Ninth Circuit opinion, and then there have been several cases that follow Silverman, which says that the co-conspirator statement by itself is not sufficient to show that a defendant is part of a conspiracy and make that statement itself admissible.
So does your argument on this, though, depend on excluding the Avila testimony?
I think that the error was not harmless as the conviction. Even you don't have to get to the Avila testimony. I think that the letter in and of itself.
And why is that? It seems like if we disagree with you on Avila, it seems like it's hard to see how there wasn't plenty of evidence that they were both trying to escape.
I would disagree. I think our Avila claim is strong, but Avila is a cooperating witness. That usually that type of testimony is not considered to be particularly overwhelming or credible. If the note is not there, other than Avila, what you essentially have is another accomplice, this woman, Miss Tynan or Tuinen, I'm not sure exactly how she pronounces it, who makes
doesn't
some
even
statements.
Know who is who exactly, right?
Yeah, and she doesn't know who's who exactly. So you're essentially talking about Mr. Avila, a cooperating witness. I think that the defense should have been allowed to impeach Avila. And that was error also, but I think...
You were able to impeach him as a cooperating witness, though, right?
Yes. We just weren't allowed to get in the witness tampering. But I think the note itself is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt as to the escape conviction. And then it's our position that under Johnson versus Mississippi, if that conviction goes, then the death sentence has to be reversed as well. And the government, they've waived any argument to the contrary. They didn't address that at all.
Is that reconciled with Clemens versus Mississippi, though? Doesn't Clemens say you can rebalance the factors even if you strike an aggravator?
Well, the difference in this case is that the particular circumstance here is that a conviction that is being used to buttress the penalty is being overturned. Clemens didn't involve that. And Johnson versus Mississippi, that's what happens. If the conviction that's used to buttress the sentence is overturned, then the death sentence must be overturned as well.
So maybe I misunderstood this. So did there have to be this conviction for the escape charge to get the death penalty?
They argued other aggravating factors, but in Johnson versus Mississippi, there were other aggravating factors as well. The vacated conviction.
I thought in Johnson it was the only one.
No, there were three aggravating factors, and that was only one of the three. It was the same circumstance in Johnson versus Mississippi.
I'll read Johnson again, but Clemens talks about even when an aggravator is stricken to rebalance. So would we need to rebalance ourselves, or you're saying we wouldn't be in a position to rebalance?
Well, I think that under Johnson, you can't. But if you did, I guess I would term it more harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, whether you think that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt under the FDPA. And it's our position that given that the escape was so central to the future danger issue, that it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've cited in our briefs, and I know they're long and they're probably lost somewhere, but the statistical evidence is overwhelming that jurors who find defendants future danger vote for death. Jurors who don't find future danger vote for life. And the statistical evidence is overwhelming, and that's reflected in the case law as well. So it's our position that even if the court thinks you can do a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis on this, the error wasn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Just, I know I'm over.
But this kind of gets you to the verdict form issue. Can you talk about that?
The verdict form issue, the government has recently cited the Umana case, but the issue in Umana is really different than what we're contending. We're arguing the jury instructions, and that's what we're really focusing on, and that the jury instructions marshaled the government's evidence and essentially allowed the jury to infer that the underlying theories of future danger that the government was relying on do actually support future dangerousness. And that really wasn't addressed in Umana at all.
Did you object to those particular jury instructions?
Yes. This issue, and I know we've talked about preservation some other, this one is thoroughly preserved. It really is. I can give the court the ER sites, but they're... It's,
sure. Well, give them to me.
They are... Let me get them. I hate to keep you waiting now, but it generally starts at about 2695 of the ER, and it goes from there. And there is a lengthy discussion of it.
So thank you.
It is well preserved.
That's fine.
Finally, just a couple quick things on the 1203. And I know the court didn't ask for this, but I just want to clarify a couple things. The government has claimed plain error as to this issue, and I just think the government is wrong there. There was preserved Rule 29 motions, general Rule 29 motions, throughout the trial, after the government's case, after the defense case, at the close of all the evidence. That preserves the issue.
Okay, tell us your best argument. Let's just assume that it's going to be straight up de novo.
Okay, straight up de novo. Bond 2 came out after we submitted our opening brief. Bond 2 says that in interpreting a statute like this, which is enacted to implement a non-self-executing treaty, that the court has to look to the treaty to determine its meaning and context, and that in doing so, the court must look to the preamble to the treaty. And that's what the court exactly did in Bond 2. The preamble to the treaty here says that it is meant to target hostage taking as a manifestation of international terrorism.
Right, as a manifestation. It's illustrative. It appears at the end of the preamble. It's just one consideration. It's not devoted to it. There's nothing in the treaty that suggests that is the sole purpose, or that is going to be an element of the crime that it expects from the signatories.
Well, Bond also said that, in addition to the preamble, you sort of have to look at the general, what is the purpose of this? What is the history? What gave rise to the treaty? And what gave rise to the treaty was all these incidents of, you know, airplane.
Even if you do that, this is not a self-executing treaty. So this has now been enacted by Congress. Among the authorities for which Congress may claim would be a Holland versus Missouri. That is, it's enacting it pursuant to its the executive's authority to enter into treaties. But there are other provisions of the Constitution under which it might do so. It might do so under the Foreign Commerce Clause. It might do so under the Commerce Clause. It might do so under the Immigration Clause. It might do under some combination of immigration and foreign affairs authority. It certainly might do so under the Piracy Clause, the International Offenses Clause. So there's a whole host of things that Congress might assert as authority here.
And that's why I'd like to focus. That's why I'm getting to the statutory construction. Putting the constitutional questions aside, what Bond 2 says is that the presumption in interpreting a statute like this is that Congress did not intend to intrude on the state's general police power. That's the presumption, the applicable presumption in interpreting these types of statutes. So even if you somehow the treaty can be interpreted to mean that it applies to all forms of hostage taking, not just related to international terrorism, Bontu says you still have to presume the way you construe federal criminal statutes is that Congress will not intrude on the state's police power in this type of manner. So, I mean, again, we really go back to Bontu and the statutory analysis that was conducted in Bontu.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for giving me the additional time.
Okay. Mr. Coleman, I will allow you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Tanaka?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Michael Tanaka, Deputy Federal Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Mr. McHill. I want to start with the Batson issue. Here, after the prosecutor struck 11 of the 13 minority, used 11 of his first 13 strikes to strike minority jurors, defense counsel made a Batson motion. And rather than dealing with that in a real way, the court simply asked the prosecutor for reasons for the last juror, and then once they started quibbling about whether it was 11 out of 13 or 13 out of 13, court cut off discussion and said, we're done, let's run. And that was the end of the discussion. Now, Batson requires a comprehensive, serious evaluation of the prosecutor's intent at that point. Once a prima facie case has been made, then it's the court's duty to meaningfully evaluate those reasons. And that has to appear on the record.
Let's assume arguendo that the district judge failed to do that with respect to the third prong of Batson. Yet we have the situation here where they're talking about 285, who was an African-American female, but the defense actually struck more African-Americans than did the prosecution, and you ended up with a jury composed of 5 whites, 3 Hispanics, 2 African-Americans, 1 Asian juror, and 1 multi-race juror. So in this particular case, if we assume arguendo that the judge should have undertaken the type of analysis that the third prong usually contemplates, what do we do here? What's the standard of review? Is this structural error? Is this de novo review? Is it abuse of discretion? Is it clear error? What are we looking at here?
It's clearly de novo, and although the composition of the final jury is relevant, it's not controlling.
It's relevant. The prosecution indicated there was a concern about whether this juror would be willing to impose the death penalty. They also mentioned that this prospective juror her father was in jail for a drug offense. But on balance, that was the reason given. So far as I know, there was no determination made by the judge or even a dispute by the defense that those reasons were not bona fide, that they made no sense. What do we do with that?
That's the very problem, Your Honor. There was no determination made by the judge that those were the actual reasons for the strike and not pretextual. Now, as we go back on de novo review and look in the entire record, we can see that they were, in fact, pretextual because those reasons applied equally to a whole host of jurors who the government chose not to strike.
Let's just focus for now on the on the government's proffer that juror 285 was lukewarm on the death penalty. So who else was lukewarm on the death penalty? That would have shown that this was pretext.
Juror 84, for example, said they hated to see anyone put to death.
Okay, was juror 84 passed on before juror 285 was?
Yes.
You said yes or no? I didn't.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And what did juror 284 say?
Juror 84 said he hates to see anyone be put to death, although he could impose the death penalty, which is showed more hesitation than Juror 285.
Well, that's your evaluation of it, but I mean, can you see where in the minds of the mind of the prosecution at that point that that may have been, they may have been more reassured by 84 than 285?
Certainly. I mean, you can go back to any particular juror and say, well, maybe, but you have to consider the whole pattern and look at all the strikes and look at all the jurors. If the court had done that, then fine, but the court didn't do that. And we're left.
Okay,
with
and I get your point. I've looked at the analysis that you have in your brief and so on. But as I look at it, I'm not seeing, I want you to help me if I'm missing this, I'm not seeing evidence of pretext. I see some close calls. I see some jurors who remained on the jury, who were not stricken, including an African-American, who said things that were kind of questionable about the death penalty as far as the prosecution was concerned. But as you will know far better than I do, in these kinds of things, it's facial expressions, it's body language, it's the whole kit and caboodle, which is why this special hearing is what's normally required. But ultimately, the prosecutors are entitled to make a value judgment. They have to articulate it. And obviously, if they said, you know, we exclude someone for a reason that is clearly false, provably false, and then they didn't exclude a white person, is exactly the same thing, that's a different deal. But in this case, would you not agree that as you analyze these jurors, there's not one that remained on the jury that was absolutely, you know, so different from 285 that we shouldn't even be talking about it? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I'm sorry. I think okay. That's my point, isn't it? That these jurors weren't any different from 285, and the prosecutor chose not to strike them.
The colloquy with juror 84 is really thin. His answers on the questionnaire are actually quite different from hers. He says, I don't like to see it done, but I understand that it's reserved for the worst crimes. When he's asked about it on orally, he said, I really hate to see anybody put to death, but I can see the reason for it in today's society. Questioner, are you a person who would consider yourself to be basically neutral going into that process? I think so.
Okay, yes.
How is this evidence of pretext?
Well, I think if the situation reversed and the prosecutor struck that juror and kept 285, you can make the exact same argument. 285 evidenced no hesitation toward avoiding death. The best
no hesitation
to is life is
counsel,
a gift.
Counsel, that's just not true, is it? She wouldn't answer the question. And the question was put to her several times. Could you consider the death penalty? I couldn't consider it now because I don't know what it is. They were then put to a hypothetical. If we had the evidence, would you consider it? Well, I'm not going to do that. That's a very, very different kind of colloquy than we had with juror 84. Now, do you have anybody else besides 84? This is the sole comparator that the district court should have taken into account was 84. That's your best case. Is juror 84?
Juror 84 is the best case, but respectfully, Your Honor, I think you're taking that a little bit out of context with respect to the jurors' responses. So,
do you dispute the accuracy of what my colleague has read?
Here's Ms. Meyer's question. Depending on the evidence as you've heard it, could you consider either punishment, either life imprisonment or the death penalty? I can't consider it right now because I don't know what it is.
Okay, so let's stop there. Either penalty, either life imprisonment or the death penalty. One can equally say from that exchange that she was lukewarm towards life imprisonment. There's nothing to distinguish her with respect to the death penalty on that question.
Well, if she's lukewarm towards life imprisonment, the government ought to be really concerned since the only other alternative is acquittal.
The point being that she didn't express any hesitation
there are a whole bunch of factors that we have no way of reading from the cold record. But if this is the best comparator you've got, it's hard to look at this and to say, oh, well, of course, the district court obviously should have questioned the motives of the prosecutor.
We have much more than that, Your Honor. I mean,
I asked you for your best case. Give me, this is the best one. Is there another one I should look at?
I think all of them.
All of them? Is there another juror you want me to look at?
All the jurors that we mentioned expressed neutrality. I guess we sort of disagree on the premise here that she was lukewarm. The only question she refused to answer is the one that the court found improper.
But ultimately, do you not agree that what we're looking at is did the prosecution strike 285 as a pretext? And your comparator gave an answer about the death penalty. 285 did not. She declined to do so. We don't know about body language or anything else, but that was one of the things they were concerned about. Obviously, the prosecution felt that 84 said enough that they were comfortable. Where's the evidence of pretext there?
The evidence of pretext stems from that the prosecutor struck blacks at a rate far greater than their presence on the veneer.
That can be a factor, but in each case, the defense struck blacks too. So the question is there evidence of pretext? The prosecutor was obviously very angry in the exchange, the colloquy with the judge, that even the very idea that someone was stricken based on the color of their skin. And you look at the ultimate juror selection, I think the Caucasians were hugely outnumbered by everybody else. So I'm not sure I understand if 84 is our comparator, why.
That could be, but that's only because the prosecutor wasn't able to strike all the minorities.
That's your position, but what's your evidence of that?
Was the prosecutor out of strikes?
Pardon?
Was the prosecution out of strikes? I thought they still had some at the end, no?
They clearly did.
They clearly did, but they don't have to strike all the minority jurors.
I just thought you were just saying that they couldn't strike everyone. I thought that's what you were just saying.
No, I'm saying that. They struck other 18 strikes that they exercised. They used two of them against two of them against white people. So that's two out of 18. Out of 18 strikes, they used six of them against black people.
So can you compare this to Snyder versus Louisiana and why you think this is not clear error, under the clear error standard that Snyder uses, given that Snyder didn't really have a judge who gave him any more explanation than the judge here?
I'm sorry.
So Snyder versus Louisiana is a Supreme Court case that applies clear error as the standard of review, even though the judge there denied the Batson challenge without really more evaluation of the prosecution's reasons than, as I read it, this judge did.
I guess we have to, Snyder seems to say that a summary denial isn't sufficient. And then.
Well, the court disagreed and thought there was clear error, but I think it's applying the clear error standard, not de novo, which is the standard you're asking for.
Well, I could be wrong. I'll have to look at that. But de novo is the standard that this court and the Supreme Court has applied throughout when their judge hasn't completed or properly finished step three, and that's
But ultimately, even if we apply de novo review, there are lots of things that people can evaluate that we can't see on a cold record. So we have to rely on what the record shows. And in this particular case, you've given, for example, Juror 84. We've already talked about this. This is your best example. And in that case, there are legitimate reasons why the prosecutor could have said, you know, I'm okay with this juror. They're okay. But the other one won't answer the questions. I'm concerned. Plus, you've got the father in prison. I'm a little concerned. That's not pretext.
Well, it could be, Your Honor. And the problem is
this wasn't explored. Is that the standard that it could be? It doesn't have to be evidence that it was.
If the court doesn't believe it is, then we... then the remedy is to remand for a potential hearing, because the reason that we don't have this record...
What would a hearing prove at this point? What would a hearing look like at this point?
Yeah, I think it might be very difficult, but that's the problem. The court didn't fulfill its duty. So all these questions...
Can I ask you why you haven't mentioned the answer on Juror 285's form where she said too seldom? I thought you were going to be talking about that the whole time, and you haven't mentioned it. Is there some reason why you haven't mentioned it?
No, I don't. But I clearly disagree with Judge Bybee's characterization as her being reluctant or lukewarm on the death penalty. She gave answers that suggested she could do both, and they gave answers that would give either side pause, and one of them being that it was too seldom to be a deterrent, suggesting that she thought it might be needed to be imposed more frequently. But in any case, we have, at that point, 11 minority jurors struck, and the court didn't even bother to ask reasons on the other 10. So we're missing that whole piece of the record because the judge didn't do his duty.
But counsel, as I mentioned earlier, the ultimate composition of the jury there were people, Hispanics, African-Americans, Asians, and multi-race jurors. There were plenty of strikes left to the prosecution. If given your theory, why didn't they just strike all those people and have all whites?
Well, you know, respectfully, obviously there would be some minority jurors the prosecutor would like, but all things being equal, if they're striking them based on their race, that's a clear violation of the Constitution.
If in fact that's what was done, you're absolutely right, of course. But you have to have some evidence that that's the reason why it was done. And that's what I'm struggling with, and I think my colleagues are struggling with, is that if you're looking at 84, I don't see it. I really don't. I mean, there's a clear distinction in my mind between 84 and 285.
Well, let me wrap up, because I feel like I'm not convincing you and we're going in circles. But at this point, we know that there was clearly a prima facie case. 11 of 13 jurors struck them in minority. Two, we don't know why the court didn't fulfill its duty, so we don't know anything about the other 10 or why the prosecutor struck them. Three, we know that he gave two reasons for the single juror, and if we look at the record, well, you might say, yeah, well, she seemed worse than this particular one, but on balance, I urge you to go back and look at those.
I have. I've looked at that. So have my colleagues. We've read it ad nauseum.
And so they all, none of them expressed any enthusiasm for the death penalty.
Let me ask you.
And then we haven't talked about the second reason he gave, which was that her father had been jailed at some point on drug charges. And clearly there were two or three other jurors who had presented a greater problem on that one. And, of course, the law is just one reason is pretextual, that's sufficient. But of those three jurors, two of them had actually been convicted of crimes themselves, had brushes with the law. So
let me get back to a point that my colleague raised, which I don't think you answered, which is, at this point, if you are correct, and pretext was shown here, what is the remedy? Throw the whole thing out?
The court could try to remand for a hearing at this point.
You can't. I mean, the juries aren't even all alive. They're older. They're all these things. This is 2006 or 7.
That probably, likely,
so you can't
almost
do it.
Certainly can't be done.
You can't be done. So what does that mean? You throw everything out, right?
If we went back to a hearing and we could find that, and we have the process, and we have the, I assume we might have the AUSAs around, what would we ask them?
No, I agree. I don't think there can be a hearing.
And wouldn't that be a very short hearing? Wouldn't we ask them, said, did you really think that that juror 285 was lukewarm? And if the answer is yes, how what purpose
would
that
serve? We would have to talk at that point about some of the other jurors as well. But
juror 84, this is going to be a very, very short hearing, Counselor.
Yeah, and I think I agree.
It probably won't take as much time as we've taken today.
I think it's probably not possible. So then the remedy is clear. The conviction has to be vacated. And
that's the whole trial, right?
Snyder says that that's the whole trial.
Both the guilt phase and the penalty phase.
Yes.
Just start from scratch.
That's correct.
Does that make sense to you?
That's the law.
Given the evidence that you have cited us to, where we're looking at a proof of pretext, admittedly we're trying to parse it through a cold record here. You don't see the body language or anything else, and you're saying that based upon that read that the evidence is clear, there was pretext, and so we throw this whole thing out.
Yes, that's what the Supreme Court did in Snyder. That's clearly what happens.
And you think that's this case? You think, pardon? Snyder is this case?
I think that is this case, Your Honor. Let's move on to competency. The Due Process Clause requires that any trial, that any person charged with a crime be competent. Here, there was abundant, almost overwhelming evidence that would require the judge to have a serious inquiry into McHale's competence. Started well before trial, when he had two near fatal suicide attempts. Then, on the eve of trial, there was a third suicide attempt. At that point, there was some diagnosis. We heard from two psychiatrists and the prison psychologist who said McHale had a serious mental disorder. The psychologist said it was a major mental depressive disorder. The treating psychiatrist...
The district court issued an order in early September of 2006. I didn't see that order in the record. Do you know what that order said?
The order, it is...
This is an order, I assume, to Dr. Ely.
Well, the order is actually just to have him tested.
To have him tested. And so that's what gives us the Ely report.
Right.
Who looked at Dr. Dillon and Dr. Vicari's records.
Correct. Okay.
So the district court actually did order an evaluation by somebody, for which he gets a very lengthy report from Dr. Ely. The Ely report is considered by the district court in an ex parte proceeding with you. So the district court actually had quite a bit of evidence before him, because Dr. Ely incorporated the diagnoses of Dr. Dillon and Dr. Vicari.
Well, I disagree with Dr. Ely incorporating. Dr. Ely disagreed with those diagnoses.
He disagreed.
He referenced them.
Right, but he disagreed with their ultimate diagnosis. Explained why. But the bottom line is there was quite a bit of evidence before. We have a professional disagreement as to whether it was depressive, or whether it was bipolar. But those are two choices that are fairly common diagnoses for people. So what should the district court have done? What difference should the district court have done?
Well, the district court, at a minimum, should have had Dr. Ely in.
Dr. Ely had said that McHale was competent, right?
Right, but he could have resolved. At least there were some questions as to the basis
Was the district court supposed to resolve the difference between the doctors as to whether this was a depressive incident or whether he was bipolar?
He's supposed to resolve the difference between.
Is he supposed to resolve that difference? He doesn't have a diagnosis from any doctor concluding that he's not competent to stand trial, that he doesn't understand the charges against him, or he's not able to assist in his defense. There isn't anybody who said that. So is he required to resolve as a matter of fact the difference between the doctors as to what the diagnosis is?
I believe so, but I don't want to end there. I mean, Dr. Vicari did say that his bipolar disorder compromised the rationality of his thinking, which speaks, although not opinion of incompetence, comes like 7/8 of the way there. But in any case, the basis for Dr. Ely finding him incompetent was that Mikkel could be treated on medication. And to whatever extent defense counsel acceded to that.
It not only doesn't object to not having further proceedings, but says, I think the medication is going to help things. Let's see how things go. And we don't hear another word. So everybody who's observing Mr. Mikkel.
No, we don't hear another word on September 14th.
That's right. Not until the end of November.
And then in November, it says, defense counsel said, well, I know I said that he might be okay with medication. But
okay. So did the district court commit an error? I want to get to November. Did the district court commit error in September?
Our position, and it's in the brief, is that he did, but.
Okay. And the error was because the district court should have done what?
We won't stand and fall on that. I think she brought Dr. Ely in.
And done what with him, though?
Question him as to why he was rejecting Dr. Vickery's.
He explained it. He went to the DSM. He explained what he thought they were missing. He acknowledged their records. This is a professional disagreement. We went for a second opinion. We got a second opinion. It was different from the first opinion. Both of them agreed that he had a depressive component to his diagnosis. They disagreed as to whether he was manic.
Your Honor, then let's move to November 30th. I think it matters not for the analysis or the ultimate result at what point the court erred in not seriously examining this
question. Okay, so in November, okay, what additional information do we have, and what error did the district court commit? And it's got to be plain error at this point, because he's already got stuff on the record that says Mikkel's competent. He's been watching Mikkel now for the last 3 months.
Yes.
And he's got no request from counsel for a competency hearing. Counsel doesn't like the way his client's behaving, but these are pretty common complaints. I mean, we see these a lot.
They are, but they're not necessarily, I mean, in this case. Now we're starting to develop evidence that's due to his mental disorder, and that's the key component of the competency question.
Okay, so what's the evidence?
So on November 30th, counsel says he's no longer being medicated. He's observed him now. He's observed him being examined. And he believes another evaluation is necessary. The court dismisses that out of hand. Says, I have all the information I need. I don't need another evaluation. Counsel says he's been uncooperative. Then a week later, says he's been uncooperative for 4 years in talking about discussing Mikkel's motion to relieve counsel.
Okay. Counsel doesn't move for a competency hearing, does he?
No, but 2 weeks earlier, counsel had asked for another evaluation.
Okay. Did he file papers?
No, he did not.
Okay. Did he mention a statute? Did he ask? I mean, what form did this take?
He just essentially says, in essence, that I have a question as to his continuing competency. He didn't use that word because he's no longer being medicated. And we all agreed that maintaining him was subject and premised on his being medicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
but
I want another evaluation.
Although counsel hasn't said that he's not able to understand the proceedings or able to cooperate in his defense. Now
he's not cooperating in terms of giving witnesses.
He's a truculent personality. No question. He's a difficult person to deal with. He thinks he's smarter than everybody else. But what's the problem?
The problem is that difficulty is not just because he's a jerk or difficult. It's because he has this mental disorder.
And is this now plain error on the district court's part?
It's getting there.
Well, if plain error is the standard, we would need to know this.
Oh, it's sound discretion, but
Okay, and the district court is seeing him, and he's seeing Mikkel every day. Mikkel's showing up at trial. So the district court's seeing him, and the government seems like the government might even have an interest here in moving for competency in order to preserve its trial.
So let's move on.
Nobody around him has asked is questioning his competency. Nobody in any serious way.
No lay person, Dr. Vickery, has questioned his competence.
Right, but now we're talking about November 30th. Okay, Dr. Vickery hasn't seen him in the interim. So all we've got are the people who have seen him. And the district court says, I'm getting daily reports from the Marshal Service as to, you know, on this guy's behavior. Right. I don't see anything. So where's the plain error?
Let's keep moving.
Okay.
So we get to the middle of December where there's...
This is December 12th?
We're talking about him testifying.
Okay, well, on December 12th, you get the letter requesting new counsel. And Mikkel is complaining about his counsel, says he wants to testify.
And then there's the whole following proceedings where Mikkel says he's going to testify, then he's not going to testify, and then he changes his mind and decides to testify. Mind you, at this time, everyone is telling him that that is a horrific decision. The court goes so far as to have the prosecutor preview all the evidence that's going to come in against him if he does testify. So, at best, it looks like a really bad decision to testify.
Okay.
But
counsel, in context, we've had over 30 days of excruciating testimony about five horrific murders. Been a great deal of detail about kidnapping, about demands for ransom, brutal murders, very, very deliberate dumping of these bodies in Yosemite. And all of this is now before the jury. Mikkel has been there. He has seen an overwhelming case. Most defense counsel suggest that they're, in my experience, suggest that they're, that their client not testify where the, unless there's some question of their guilt. There's no question about Mikkel's guilt here. What does, from Mikkel's perspective, what does he have to lose by testifying? From his perspective, what does he have to lose? I understand Mr. Rubin and Mr. Callahan don't think this is going to be a good idea. They think they're going to get this out of hand and think he's going to make a bad case worse. But it's already a worse case. It's a really, really bad case. So why is this a crazy decision by Mikkel to testify? Why is that evidence of incompetence?
Because it's motivated by a mental disorder. It is crazy.
And then, how do you know?
Then, well,
how do you know it's motivated by a mental disorder and not a
if we had any doubt about that, it was certainly dispelled 2 weeks later when he did testify. As Your Honor said,
he testifies. I've read that testimony. He's a very, very bright guy.
He's got, just
from what I can tell from the cold record, because I'm not listening to accents or anything, the guy's got quite a vocabulary for somebody who's not a native speaker. He is well aware of what his appeal rights may be, because his lawyer complains that he's trying to build an ineffective assistance of counsel case against him. And Mikkel admits as much. That's exactly what he's doing, because he doesn't like the strategy his lawyers have employed here. That's evidence of a disagreement over strategy, not evidence of incompetence. You and Mr. Coleman may have discussed this case and may have discussed, you know, what you might do here today. And at some point, you might have said, well, I intend to do X. And Mr. Coleman might have said, that's crazy. Well, I hope that doesn't require that we have some kind of competency hearing just because somebody thinks that something is crazy. We use those terms all the time.
Well, then this is just the next piece of it. And we look at his testimony. And whatever intelligence it shows, it doesn't show rationality, and it doesn't show competence. The first 2 days are ludicrous. He gets up there, and it's a show and tell. He's just showing vacation pictures. Here's me and my lady friend bear hunting in Canada. Here's me and my two Ferraris showing photos to the jury. I'm not sure what was going on in the judge's head, thinking that this is part of a capital trial. It was crazy, counsel.
With respect, obviously that's not what you would have done if you were the defendant in the case. But as my colleague mentioned, he did in disagreement with his lawyers. He thought that the lawyers thought they were going to set him up for an IAC claim. And in this case, it's entirely possible Mikkel knew perfectly well he was not going to submit to cross-examination. He may not have known his testimony would be stricken, but he perhaps thought somewhere he would strike something in the minds of the juror to say, well, maybe you had to give this guy a break. He's got a little trouble. Something like that. Maybe he's dumb as a fox. I had a case not too long ago where we had something very similar to that. And it's the reality is nobody said you've got to have a competency hearing. Nobody moved for it. It was just retrospectively, after the fact, we're looking at this and you're saying, oh, gee, it's just obviously crazy. That's not clear. He didn't testify very well. And he certainly had some issues. But none of the counsel moved, including, as my colleague mentioned, the prosecutor to preserve the case could very well have said, you know, we need a competency hearing here. But nobody thought that it was necessary.
Right, though the prosecutor had no interest in...
Yes, he did. He absolutely had an interest here, because if he thinks that the district court is committing plain error, then he's got an interest in keeping the district court from making a mistake that's going to get the whole thing tossed out. Yeah, he may be sitting on the sidelines and watching this go on, but he actually does have an interest here. The statute actually says that it can be on either the motion of either side.
That's true, Your Honor. In my experience,
I understand.
The government rarely moves to protect the defendant's interest because they're worried about plain error on appeal. But the testimony, he clearly was a smart guy, which then shows just how irrational this testimony was.
So we have to figure out whether he understood the proceedings and what was going on and what was at stake. And why don't the motions to get rid of his counsel show that he understood what was going on?
There's both a factional and rational component to that understanding. He had clearly a very good grasp of what court was, what was at stake in terms of what the charges were, what the procedures are. But then there's a component that he has to also have a rational understanding. That is, he has to be able to consult with his lawyer, to assist his lawyer in presenting a defense. So if his mental disorder, his bipolar disorders, his delusions, his grandiosity are preventing him from considering what would be a real defense, instead of a defense showing what a great person he was, how valuable he was to preventing cancer, and those kinds of things that had zero place in this trial and were not in any way, shape, or form a defense. On top of that, if this is supposedly an intelligent person, they would certainly understand that.
If I were his counsel and I thought I had a client who had this kind of evidence against him but was supporting cancer research, I sure would have tried to get that in there.
Right, if that were in fact true.
Mr. Tanaka, one of the things that concerns me about your argument is that this also suggests that any time, for example, if we had a Feretta motion, so any time you had a Feretta request, that a district court almost automatically, in order to be defensive, would have to ask for a competency hearing.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. If there were a Feretta request and then the client or the man got up and just spewed crazy stuff, then maybe. Or if we knew that this man had tried to commit suicide 3 times before trial, that
The doctor's evaluations of that, though, were that he had despaired as to how the trial was coming out. He despaired for what his future was, which in light of the overwhelming case against him, was actually pretty realistic.
Sorry, at what point? At this point of the suicide attempts?
Yeah, the doctor's evaluations after his suicide attempts suggested the suicidal ideation because he was despondent over what he anticipated would be the end of the trial. And that actually turns out to be pretty realistic. It turns out to be pretty rational. That's not delusional.
That was the sort of the government's spin on it. Dr. Dillon, who observed him closely over a period of months and was the only mental health professional to do so, noted all sorts of psychotic symptoms, delusions of grandeur, electricity in his head, talking to imaginary friends, staying up.
A lot of that was several years before, and we don't have any evidence after about 2004, I think, on that.
That's correct. Partially because there was never any record developed. Again, we don't have an evaluation for competency post September 2006, even though now, as I mentioned, this evidence is mounting, and you can't look at his testimony and have a question about it. Maybe there's an alternate speculative reason where it seems rational. That's not in my universe. And then, lest there be any doubt at all, Dr. Vickery comes in and says, oh, look, I saw him a couple weeks ago. He's decompensated. He's much worse than he was before. His refusal to his performance at trial is due to his bipolar disorder and inadequate medication and his continuing isolation under SAMS. I'm more or less said the man was incompetent. I mean, he probably would have said that, except that it was in the course of testimony, and the government objected to the opinion of whether it was his bipolar disorder that was causing him to do all these things.
So this testimony now is down after the guilt phase, is that right?
Correct.
So now the question is whether he understood the proceedings in the penalty phase and was able to cooperate with counsel during the penalty phase.
It's all cumulative, Your Honor. It's like this all shows that he's been incompetent, or there's been a question about his competence the entire time. But every piece of evidence mounts. And it's not like he becomes incompetent at this point because, based on this evidence. It's that this is just on a series of points, data points, showing the district court that this man is, there's a question, serious question as to his competence. He's facing capital charges, and his behavior, coupled with his psychiatric history, coupled with the psychiatric diagnosis, then added on to the testimony of the doctors at the penalty phase, screams out, something is amiss here. The judge at that point has a duty, a constitutional duty to inquire.
Are you saying that the judge at that point should sua sponte have called for a competency hearing?
Yes.
And what case would you cite for that?
Drope versus Missouri, Your Honor. There's a number of cases cited in the brief, but all of them place the duty on the court to determine or to assure competency, or assure the defendant is competent.
So even though the judge has heard the testimony or read the views of several different physicians, each of whom have indicated that he seems to understand the nature of the proceedings, is able to assist his counsel says so from time to time, you're talking about a cumulative effect, but the reality is he's a judge. He's not a doctor. He's heard this other testimony.
He's heard one report.
Well, and he's read these other things as well.
Which suggests that the man was incompetent.
Well, that's your view of it. It doesn't say that.
It says
he's got some mental issues, but it also says if he's medicated, it helps as well. The reality is we have lots of criminal cases where these kinds of concerns are there, and the question is he able to understand the nature of the proceedings and assist his counsel? And through virtually all of this, until he had a disagreement with his counsel, which is not at all uncommon, The counsel seemed to say it was okay.
If that's all we had, Your Honor, I agree with you. But I respectfully disagree that there are lots of cases like this. There aren't any cases like this.
Maybe I'll send you some.
I was looking for them in the government's brief, and I couldn't find them. But we have all these indicators, and I won't burden you with going through them again. But
thank you.
From the 2 years preceding trial all the way up through the penalty phase testimony, there's just overwhelming evidence that raised a serious question as to his competence.
I gather, counsel, that your point is, notwithstanding what we talked about at an earlier point, it's the cumulative effect of all of this that should have triggered this in the judge's mind. Is that your point?
The continuing duty on the part of the judge to assure the defendant is competent.
And at what point did this occur in your mind? Well, it wasn't in the guilt phase, right?
We've made the argument that it occurred at all the points.
I know you made the argument, but let's be realistic.
It doesn't really matter. Certainly by the penalty phase, it had occurred. Okay. And that's all that counts. I mean,
it's the penalty phase you're focused on.
By the time of the penalty phase, question as to his competence was clearly
wrong. And if we agree with you as to the penalty phase, that the judge had a duty sua sponte to call for a competency hearing, the remedy then would be, it would have to be a reversal of everything because it has to be the same jury that decides the penalty phase. We can't reconstitute the jury here, so we would have to retry the case?
If he was incompetent, yes.
If his incompetence, the onset of his incompetence was only during the penalty phase.
I'm not sure, but I think that's question here. I think
doesn't your answer have to be that because the same jury must consider the penalty, is considered the guilt, then that if the penalty phase is infirm, then the whole thing must go back?
Yes.
Anything further, Mr. Tanaka?
Well, the court had indicated that it was interested in hearing further argument on the exclusion of the mitigation videos, and I'm prepared to speak to that.
I don't need to hear.
Thank you, and I will give you time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay. I think the court is going to take a five-minute break, so we stand adjourned.
All rise. May it please the Court, Anthony Brown for the United States. Your Honors, I'm not sure where you'd like me to start. If you don't have any preference, I'm going to start where I think I can supplement the facts from the government's brief on a couple of the issues to help put some of the contested issues in better context. And so I'd like to start with the conspiracy claim. This is Mr. Katimovas's contention about the conspiracy claim and Mikkel's letter in particular. And one of the things that I think could have received more emphasis in the government's brief and that I'd like to point out now is that the district court was basing its decision not only on the fact of Mikkel's letter, which had inside the letter itself.
But we're talking about the escape?
You're talking about the conspiracy to escape.
Yeah, this is the first escape attempt. This is the post-escape or post-discovery letter from Mikkel Katimovas. Says, look, we made some mistakes when we did this.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. And Mr. Katimovas' claim that it was error to admit the letter against him for purposes of the conspiracy. And there were actually two letters that were found. What happened was Mr. Mikkel called one of the guards from the jail over. At the time Mr. Mikkel was in the SHU, this was after the escape conspiracy had been found. Mr. Katimovas was also in the SHU, and what happened was Mr. Mikkel tried to pass a magazine to him through one of the guards. And in the magazine, there were actually two letters, not just the letter to Mr. Katimovas. There was a second letter that was addressed to one of the co-conspirators, who was Tom Tynan. And that letter said, "Hi, T, I got your hello through 6 North." And the letter also says, "After I have established communication with my friends, who are all here, we have a big conference and had a lot of decisions." And I think
when you think that shows evidence of an escape conspiracy with Katimovas?
Yes, I think it shows that there was a continuing conspiracy for the escape. Because remember that at this point, I believe that at this point, Mr. Tynan had not been discovered as a co-conspirator in the case. But he had been identified as a potential co-conspirator.
But how do we have any idea what they're talking about? Maybe they're talking about buying bubble gum or something. I mean, that doesn't say anything about escape, does it?
Well, if you consider it alone, possibly. But if you consider it in the context of all the other facts that were introduced that showed that Mr. Katimovas was involved in a conspiracy to escape, then it shows that there's a continuing conspiracy going on here. Because remember, the opening line from the letter to Katimovas said, "Yuruk, let's start putting into motion my big bluff. Out of concern for security, for now, I won't describe the details."
Counsel, you're saying that it was appropriate to admit this letter against Katimovas?
Yes. Because
I thought that all of this had already been disclosed, so that the conspiracy effectively had ended previously. March 17th? Yeah, Katimovas confessed on March 17th. This letter doesn't come out until March 28th?
March 26th, I believe.
March 26th.
Yes.
So there might be evidence of a second conspiracy, but the rule is that you've got to have some other evidence of the second conspiracy. Where's the evidence?
Well, what the court actually found was that the conspiracy had started up again, and
based on what?
Based on the fact that the letter was being passed to Katimovas.
Yeah, but you have to have other evidence. That was the whole problem. You have to have other evidence besides the letter. What other evidence do you have that Katimovas was participating in a conspiracy?
That's what I was trying to say, is there was a second letter, and the letter to another co-conspirator who was also involved in that escape plan, one of the main people in the escape plan, Tom Tynan, pointed out that Mikkel had said, "I've established communication with my friends who are all here, and we have a big conference and had a lot of decisions."
I don't understand how that shows that this conspiracy to escape, as opposed to some other thing they might have been talking about or anything else, was being reignited.
Well, that would ignore all the other evidence that the person that he's addressing the letter to, and the person that he tried to address the letter to, Katimovas, the second letter, were all already involved in a conspiracy to escape.
But that had been discovered, and that's the question. I mean, how can you admit this letter as a co-conspirator letter when the conspiracy was over?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. I don't think the conspiracy was over. That's not what the judge found. I want to just bring that to the court's attention. In any event, even if it was error to admit the letter, I think the error obviously was harmless, and that shouldn't affect the verdict on the conspiracy charge. I mean, there was an overwhelming amount of evidence that showed that Mr. Katimovas was involved in the conspiracy, and the key evidence there was that Mr. Katimovas had moved himself over to the stairwell. Where
this is through the Avila testimony?
This is through the testimony of several people. And this is, again, why I wanted to address this first, because I think maybe could have done a better job in the brief of getting it all forward. There were several FBI agents who testified. One of them was Marvin Batley, and he testified that Katimovas was actually sanctioned for moving over to that cell next to the stairwell. He was later allowed to move there, but he initially moved there without permission. And the other, Krylov and Mikhail, followed him afterwards. There was also testimony that, Mr.
All of this goes to show the first conspiracy.
That's correct.
And this evidence is good. But effectively, that conspiracy ends on March 17th.
Well, I'm saying, assuming that you think the conspiracy ended, now I'm talking about the additional evidence that showed
the addition of the letter would be harmless.
That's okay. Correct, Your Honor. There was also an FBI agent named Ingrid Sotelo who testified, and she found notes in Mikhail's cell with Krylov's, David Avila's, and Michael Cook's registration numbers on them. And she testified that each of them had received money from Mikhail, and each had a role in the escape plan. Well, we also know that Katimovas received money on his books at the same time that each of those people did on March 6th. Now, in the brief, I think I mistakenly suggested that was on the eve of the escape, but it was on the eve of the discovery of the escape. I think that is further evidence that Katimovas was involved in the escape. Now, look, Avila clearly
can
testified.
Can you use money that's in your prison account outside of prison?
I don't know the answer to that.
Because it seems odd to transfer money to a prison account if the whole point is to get out of prison. Doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to say. No, remember.
I mean, you're saying that they transferred money to his prison account, and that shows they must have been trying to escape, but it sounds counterintuitive. I'm not sure how it works.
Because the escape plan was not, I don't think they were ready to escape on March 6th. I didn't want to leave the misleading impression from the brief that they were ready to bust out on March 7th. They weren't. Remember, Katimovas didn't have a hole in the wall of his cell at that point, and Krylov and Mikhail did. So I think it was going to take a little bit more time for them to do it. What I think it shows is that Michael Cook, who was the person whose cell through which they brought in all of the materials, David Avila, another person who was involved in the conspiracy, Krylov, who was involved in the conspiracy, and Kadamovas, who was involved in the conspiracy, they all were getting paid by Mikhail. And I think it shows that these people had a special relationship, and that's evidence of the conspiracy as well. And then there's Avila's testimony, and he obviously went into Katimovas' cell and heard him talking to Mikhail through the air vents. I don't think I need to go any further into that unless you have other questions. I did want to say, just in terms of the harmlessness on that particular issue, to the extent that it has any effect on the death penalty phase of the trial. I agree with you, Judge Friedland, that the harmlessness at the death penalty stage would require a rebalancing the factor. So to the extent that this affected the future dangerousness finding, what the court would have to do at that point would do rebalancing. I think both.
I didn't think you argued harmlessness, though, for the penalty phase for this issue, did you?
I think we argued harmlessness with respect to future dangerousness in a sort of general context.
But as to this letter, if it was error.
We did not. I have three responses to that. One is Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52A says that if there's any harmless error, then the court has to uphold or cannot disregard any harmless error. Second, both the Federal Death Penalty Act and Mitchell interpreting the Federal Death Penalty Act have held that that the court has a sort of independent obligation to review for harmlessness. I think that's in 35.
Do you think the Gonzales-Flores standard that we usually apply would be the standard?
I don't think so, because there's a statute on point here, 3595. Says that the court has to review for harmlessness, and Mitchell also says applying that standard.
So the government has no, there's no difference whether the government makes the argument or not?
I would say under the circumstances, if the government just, if the government clearly conceded an argument, then maybe that wouldn't apply. I doubt that given what the statute says, but under the circumstances where we clearly argued harmlessness, with respect to the future dangerous factor in other contexts and where it would be really easy to apply it here, I think the court should apply it and should not hold that it was waived by the government. There's one other aspect of future dangerousness here that I want to mention too, is that if you're reviewing for harmlessness on that fact, an important point to keep in mind is that in reweighing the factors, the government actually at closing argument really essentially told the jury that they could disregard on future dangerousness if they wanted to. The government argued to the jury that future dangerousness was both a non-statutory factor and also not even that important of a factor to consider. And in fact, I think if I can quote it correctly, what the government prosecutor said was, we're not asking you to sentence these defendants to death because of what they might do in the future. We're asking you to sentence them to death because of what they did in the past.
And so why was it on the verdict form? And well, I mean,
I'm saying is, in the harmlessness analysis, the emphasis that's given by the prosecutor to those particular factors is one of the aspects the court should take into consideration. And I'm pointing out that the government de-emphasized that pretty specifically in a way that I just quoted. And so I think that weighs against a harmful error finding in this case. I want to turn to Batson, and I want to take a stab at the standard of review. This is an unusual set of facts, I'll agree. But I think
the standard of review for what aspect of the case?
The standard of review for how to review the whether there was Batson error or not.
Oh, Batson.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. And so, the question is, should we review it de novo or should we review it normally the way that Batson is reviewed, which is clear error? And I want to point out that not only Snyder, but also this court's decision in Gillum says that neither Batson nor its progeny requires that the trial judge make specific findings beyond ruling on the objection. The judge ruled on the objection here. I think that's pretty clear. The judge reached step three. There is no indication whatsoever that the judge applied the wrong standard. And under the circumstances, I think it should be ruled for, or the review should be for clear error.
But counsel, doesn't your opposition make the valid point that the third prong of Batson requires a significant, thoughtful review so that you can really plumb whether there's pretext involved? It's true the judge says, let's move on after the heated exchange between the counsel, but there was no searching review here. We really have to view this, do we not, based on the actual facts, which no such hearing occurred, no such analysis occurred. And under those circumstances, is clear error the standard, or are we looking at de novo, as your opposition suggests?
I think it's still clear error, and let me explain why.
Okay.
In Murray v. Schreiro, this court said that there are no formal steps that the trial court must take to evaluate the prosecutor's credibility. And Murray v. Schreiro suggested that depending upon the nature of the claims that were made, there might be the court might be required to go into more or less depth in terms of its analysis. And what I would suggest is that once the government offered the two reasons for why it struck juror number 285, the defense came up with a response that was just factually wrong. It was complete error. They said you had struck only minority jurors, and in fact, the government had struck two white jurors. Under those circumstances, I don't think that the judge has there's much analysis to do. The whole basis for the Batson challenge was demonstrably wrong. And under those circumstances, I think that the degree of the analysis is minimal.
So your position then that colloquy is all that was necessary. The fact that there was an incorrect assertion by defense counsel regarding how many black jurors had been struck, the heated response by the prosecution, the admission by the defense that, in fact, there weren't all blacks had been struck. There were a white juror that had been struck as well. And the judge says, basically, let's go. You say that's it? That's enough?
I think so.
I don't understand. Are you saying that means they didn't even have a prima facie case?
Well, I think there's a question about that. And let me put it in perspective. What could have happened after this? Mikkel's counsel, who was the one who raised the Batson objection, could have said, well, based upon striking 11 out of 13 jurors who were minorities, I'm renewing my Batson challenge. He could have renewed the Batson challenge later after another black juror was struck by the prosecution, but he never did that. And he never made any statistical claim. He never made any kind of pattern claim. He never made any kind of comparison claim.
Well, it's very hard to do on the spot, right? I mean, he pointed out what he thought was a pattern. He overstated it slightly, but it seems like there was enough of a pattern to have a prima facie case, wasn't there? I didn't even know, maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I didn't think you even really contested that.
No, because once the judge asks the government to give its reasons, and then the government gives its reasons for the strike, really the step one is moot. And so at this point, we're only talking about step three.
But doing that doesn't mean that the first two steps are irrelevant. You still have the issue, do you not?
Well, no, they're not irrelevant. And the relevancy in this case was that I think, as Judge Friedland pointed out, they raise a question about whether the defense even had a prima facie case. Now, I'm not arguing that they didn't have a step one case. What I'm saying is that I think at that point, defense counsel was mistaken. And he realized he was mistaken. He did not renew the objection by saying, well, you know, 11 out of 13 is still pretty bad, Your Honor.
So is it the government's position that in analyzing this, instead of our looking at what we do with respect to step three of Batson is not the question, but whether or not by virtue of the colloquy that in effect the Batson challenge had been withdrawn because the defense counsel admitted he was mistaken about who had been struck and he never renewed the motion. Is that your position?
I'm not saying that he withdrew it. What I'm saying is he never renewed it. Now, let's keep in mind,
What's the difference for our purposes of our analysis?
Not much, except for I'm not claiming that he withdrew the claim.
Okay, let's assume arguendo that he didn't withdraw the claim, and we have a claim Batson error. The judge cut it short. Maybe they didn't want to move on with the trial, it wasn't brought up again, but it's just sitting there. How do we review this? Is this clear error? Is it de novo? And if so, why in each instance?
I'm saying that it should be clear error because the judge reached step three. The judge did not clearly apply the wrong law in this case.
If the judge didn't conduct the kind of analysis that the Supreme Court talked about in the prong three of Batson, how can you say that he ruled on that issue?
I don't think there's any requirement that the judge put all of that analysis on the record. And what I'm saying is, in light of the mistaken claim by the defense that all of the jurors that had been struck by the government were minorities, the court didn't have much analysis to do. And also in light of the fact...
So you think the judge didn't have an obligation to decide at that point whether the government's reasons for juror 285 were pretext?
I think the judge did by denying the claim. And that's what Gillum says. That's all.
So that has nothing to do with whether the defense thought it was 11 or 13. Then I don't really understand the connection, but why you're saying that the fact that the defense overstated affects the analysis of whether
because
the judge
because that was taking place at step three, Your Honor. So what happened was
is your argument that because the defense overstated its prima facie case, the judge didn't have to evaluate pretext?
No, my argument is that at step three, once the prosecution had offers its reasons, the argument that the defendant responded with was factually incorrect.
What's the result of that?
The result is, well, first of all, it's the defendant's burden to show that there's a Batson error. The defendant has to come forward with reasons for why there's a Batson error. Sure, there's an independent obligation for the judge once step one claim has been made to do some sort of analysis. But the defendant always has the burden on a Batson claim. And the defendant came forward with a factually incorrect argument about what had happened. It was an erroneous claim about the number of people that had been stricken that were minorities.
So if that's right, are you claiming then that what the judge did here was, in quotes, a sensitive inquiry into evidence of intent, which is the third prong of Batson?
What I'm saying is what counts as a sensitive inquiry can change depending upon the quality and the nature of the arguments that the defendant brings forward at step three.
So if the claim is, you know, you strike only people of color, admission wrong, end of story, that's all the analysis that's required.
Well, yes, let's take your scenario. Suppose, the defendant raised a Batson challenge, as it happened in this case. Judge turned to the prosecution. Prosecution offered reasons. And then the defense said, actually, that's not true. Everybody you struck was black. And, in fact, everybody the prosecution had struck was white. What analysis is necessary under those circumstances? There's demonstrably no Batson problem. And I think that's close to what happened
here. If this thing had been a game show, this was the lightning round. I mean, this was done so quickly that nobody discusses sort of steps, nobody uses the word pretext, nobody uses the word prima facie, and the district court just basically, I don't know whether he just was, resolving the squabble between counsel to say, let's run, we're done with this. But, it's I have to say, it's not a very satisfying colloquy for those of us who are obligated to do this on appeal. And that's, that's probably a good lesson for district judges, no matter how we decide this thing. But it does strain us to try to figure out what precisely was going on here.
Look, I've made my arguments for what the standard of review is. Before I leave that, and I'll analyze it under de novo review anyway, but before leaving that issue, I do want to point out, the people who were representing the defendants in this case were very experienced attorneys. Mr. Rubin was the one who made the objection. And you can tell from reading the record that Mr. Rubin, who I think at one point said he had 20 death penalty cases under his belt, he was not a wilting violet. He was somebody who, if he really thought that there was a claim, would have urged it, and would have urged it with a lot of ferocity, as he did with many of the other claims.
Let's assume for a minute that the claim doesn't go away. Let's assume further that the judge did not conduct the type of sensitive inquiry that was required here. What happens? You heard the analysis that we collectively went through with opposing counsel about juror 84 and 285. Is that what we're supposed to do, is to look through all of these potential jurors, find out why they were struck, like you would in, like indeed the Supreme Court has done in some cases? What is that what we're supposed to do?
Yes.
Okay.
Both parties agree that the record is sufficient for de novo review, and you should conduct de novo review the same way the judge
would. Okay, and so doing that, what is the government's best argument that the requirements of Batson were satisfied here and that the government was not shown to have struck 285 as a pretext?
Okay, again, I'm going to remind the court this is the defendant's burden.
I get that. I'm just saying, okay? What's your response?
The best response is, the jury that we ended up with in this case, statistically, was identical to the veneer in the case. There was really no difference at all. Now, it's true.
But if you strike one juror because of race, you lose anyway, right? The veneer isn't, you don't get out of it just by saying there were still African Americans on the jury.
No, that's true. But that's the ultimate determination you're talking about. I'm talking about, remember, the question here is, did that prosecutor have race in the back of his mind when he was striking the juror? All the things I'm going to talk about now, that's evidence of what was in his mind at the time. Okay, so yeah, obviously if you strike one juror because of race, that's a Batson violation. But the fact that the veneer and the jury that was ultimately selected were pretty much identical statistically, that's a very compelling fact that the prosecution was not trying to strike blacks at a rate any higher than they were actually in the veneer. In fact, there were four African Americans on the jury, two on the actual panel, and then two alternates, with, as Judge Friedland, you pointed out earlier, strikes that were still left to be made. That is another compelling fact that this is a prosecutor who wasn't out to strike African American jurors. Now, I mention all that in part because Snyder, 100% of the African Americans were struck. In Miller L, 91% of the African Americans on the jury were struck. In Batson, again, all of the African Americans on the jury struck. In Alanis, which was a case about sexual abuse, all of the men were struck. We have nothing like that here. There is, I agree, a somewhat disproportionate number of strikes against African Americans, but that doesn't bring us anywhere near the realm of the cases that I just mentioned. And then, most of the argument in defendant's brief is devoted to the comparative juror analysis. And I think that has very little probative value in this case, in part because They didn't raise the Batson objection the way they should. They didn't bring any of this evidence out and argue it below. And I want to point to
Do people usually, though? It always happens so fast. I mean, I feel like this comparative juror analysis usually happens on appeal and not really in the trial court, unless there's a hearing, which the judge here didn't have. It's hard to say that someone can line up all the exact forms and say, wait a second, she said it's not given enough, it's too seldom, and these other ones say these other things, and you do it on the spot? I mean, can you point us to cases where the defense, that's what's required for the defense to maintain their Batson challenge?
It's not required. It's certainly not required for the district court to go through that. What I want to point out, though, is the degree of Monday morning quarterbacking that's going on in the brief from the defendants. And there are two issues in particular that I want to point out before going on to the comparative juror analysis. One is, there's a quote in our brief from Davis versus Ayala, and this goes to the kind of decisions and the kind of sensitivity that the court should have to decisions about whether whether a strike based on a juror's attitude towards the death penalty is legitimate or not. And I don't normally do this, but I want to read that. They said, where attitudes towards the death penalty are concerned, prosecutors may be required to make fine judgment calls about which jurors are more or less willing to vote for the ultimate punishment. And these judgments may involve a comparison of responses that differ in only nuanced respects. That's really what's going on here. The prosecutor said juror 285 was lukewarm on the death penalty. Now, 10 years later, Mr. McKellar and the defendants are arguing, well, she really wasn't lukewarm. I'm not sure that I believe that that's the correct way to respond. If any of this had come out at the trial, we would have a better record. And since it's the defendant's burden, I think that where especially an issue about the death penalty is concerned, this court should be very skeptical about these fine lines that the defendants are trying to draw between attitudes towards the death penalty.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the burden. You say it's the burden of the defendant to prove up a Batson challenge. Since we, for purposes of our discussion, have assumed that prongs one and two have been satisfied, and all we're talking about is pretext, is it at that stage, is it the obligation of the defense to prove that the prosecution was motivated by a pretextual reason, that it was really race-based, or is it the obligation of the government to show that its strike was not motivated by pretext?
It is definitively the defendant's obligation to show that discrimination against a person because of race was a substantial motivating factor in the prosecution's decision.
Okay, and that's for the whole Batson, or is that just step three?
That's at step three.
Okay.
At step one, you have to make out a prima facie case. That's also the defense burden. At step two, what the prosecution has to do is come forward with race-neutral reasons for the strike. And then at step three, it remains the defendant's burden to prove that discrimination was a substantial motivating factor. The second thing that I want to point out about the comparative analysis is I think it's especially suspect here for a major reason. One is that the entire comparative analysis that takes place with respect to the prosecution's second reason, that juror 285 had a father in jail, which is connections with the law or connections with people in the family who have been prosecuted, that entire analysis is based on jurors that were not considered until after the Batson challenge. And what I'm saying is there's a lot of second-guessing going on in this comparative juror analysis. Had the defense renewed their Batson challenge after these three jurors, jurors number 8, 39, and 67, the prosecution clearly could have offered more reasons for how to distinguish them. And so I think that given the two things, given Davis versus Ayala and the fact that three of these jurors that are considered in the comparative juror analysis on that one issue weren't even considered by anybody, by the court, by the prosecution, by anybody until after the Batson challenge, means that the comparative juror analysis here is not worth very much. Even so, let's take a look at juror number 84.
It was juror 84. I asked this question of opposing counsel, and the answer they thought was that juror 84 was examined before juror 85. I know that there were other jurors. I think 57 was one, or 67 was one that they used in their brief that was after 285. I thought they said that 84 was prior.
That's correct. But this is on the death penalty, attitude towards the death penalty issue, okay? First, I agree with the court's characterization of juror number 285. I think from the record, it's clear that she was very hesitant to give an opinion about whether she could follow through with the death penalty. Now, a lot of people say that they're neutral on the death penalty, but when she was asked specifically in this case, if the evidence, if there was substantial evidence of the aggravating factors, and they outweighed the mitigating factors, could you vote for the death penalty? She refused to answer, and she said twice, I can't tell you. I don't know what the evidence is. And I think under the Davis v. Ayala standard for looking at prosecutors' reasons for whether or not they think that there are nuanced aspects of a juror's response, I think that is enough to show that that was a legitimate and a legitimate race neutral, but also like a legitimate difference between her response and all of the other jurors' responses. That's why I wanted to
Why weren't those responses though just either confusion about the question, like how would I know what whether I should give the death penalty when I haven't seen the evidence yet, or reluctance to say? I mean, it seems like kind of a reasonable answer. I don't know what I would think until I see the evidence. Isn't that what she was saying?
Well, I might agree with you if she didn't interrupt the prosecutor and say, I can't tell you. Now, again, this is a cold record, and it's difficult to tell from the cold record. But what's not difficult to tell is that she interrupted the prosecutor and stopped the prosecutor from even asking the question and said, I'm not going to answer. And I think that would put any prosecutor who's about to go through 6 months of a death penalty trial, I think that would give any prosecutor in that situation some deep concern.
How do you explain the too seldom note on the questionnaire?
I'm not sure how to explain that. I think that in general, her responses were a little bit all over the map. Remember, she said, "I think that the death penalty. I think life is a gift, and I would have to take some serious. Let me see if I can remember exactly what she said. She said she was neither for nor against the death penalty, but she also said the death penalty to me is no joke. Life to me is a gift. So when it comes to taking someone's life, a lot of things need to be taken into consideration." Who knows what? I think that's what the prosecutor was bearing down on. What needs to be taken into consideration? If the evidence in this case on the aggravating factor substantially outweighs the mitigating factors, can you do it? And she balked. Judge Bobbie, I wanted to go back to juror number 84 because when you were reading juror number 84, the response there, I think you left out actually the section of the response that I think is the most important. The juror said, depending on the crime, the death penalty should be a possible penalty. That's at the under seal excerpts of record of page 308. But then during the voir dire, the juror said, look, I've seen cases on TV before, you know, where you think, you know, when you've seen things that are terrible and you think, well, then they deserve it. Now, I think if I were a prosecutor and I heard that, I would say, well, here's a person who, you know, given the nature of the evidence in my case, I can count on to vote for the death penalty. And I think there's a big difference between that response and the response of juror number 285. I don't know if you want me to continue on the Batson, if you have any other questions about the Batson claim. Okay. Where would you like me to go next?
Go ahead.
So I think on the recusal issue, we had some outside the record speculation about how this process works, but since we went down that road and you're in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I'd be curious whether you think the U.S. Attorney's Office has ever asked about candidates. I would expect that they probably are asked.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer. I don't know what to tell you. If the court wants me to find out, I can try to find out, but I really don't know the answer. I mean, what I think the court got right about the analysis, at least as I'm discerning from the court's questions, is this was a screening committee with no connection to the White House and no connection to the Department of Justice. Probably it was under, the auspices of one of the senators, both of whom were Democrats. But it's not even clear that the screening committee had even passed the judge's name on or that the screening committee had reached a point where they were prepared to.
Does it matter, though? I mean, if the judge has applied and wants this job and is willing to be considered, why doesn't that raise a concern about whether he wants to get along with the office that he's trying to work for that is prosecuting this case in front of him?
Well, as Judge Bybee pointed out, it's not clear where the concern would go. Remember, the screening committee is a bunch of local lawyers, And it's also a screening committee that is ultimately going to pass names on to a couple Democratic senators who are going to pass those names on at that point to a Republican administration. So what's the bias? Is the judge going to try to curry favor with the Democratic senators or with the Republican administration? Certainly, if the U.S.
attorney's you've avoided Judge Friedland's question. So her question picked up on Mr. Coleman's point, which was the concern that what the judge was trying to do was to make sure that he had good relationships with the attorneys he would be supervising if he were to get the position. And that's a very different from trying to curry favor with folks in Washington, which was, I think, was the emphasis of my questioning. So that was a very different point that I didn't anticipate from Mr. Coleman. I think that's Judge Friedland's question, which you've avoided.
Yeah, so okay.
It's that, and I think whoever is making the decision, whether it's the senators or the White House or both or in combination or whatever, my guess is they probably would ask the office, what do you think about the candidates? So I think it's both that whoever's making the decision might ask the office and that you're going to have to supervise the office. So both things lead a judge who wants that job to want to get along with this office.
Somebody in Washington calls the acting head of the office and says, you know, we've got a couple of names that we're considering, you know, and one of them, surprisingly, is a district judge. What's been your experience with the judge? What's his reputation in your office? Do you think he would have any difficulty managing folks? And you say, the head of the office says, well, let me talk to Brown. Brown's got a case in front of him right now.
Mm-hmm.
Picks up the phone, calls you, and says, you know, has DeBresian given you any trouble? My experience has been pretty good with him over the years. What do you think? You've got a case going on right now.
I mean, that's really pure speculation. As I said, I don't really know whether anyone contacts the U.S. Attorney's Office to find out. I can tell you from my recent experience, we just had an interim U.S. attorney appointed, and no one asked me. And I'm not sure whether that goes through. I got to tell you, I'm not big potatoes over at that
office. How many AUSAs in the office?
About 200.
About 200.
Yeah.
So, you know, given the, I mean, there were a lot of steps in there in that hypothetical, but the question is, you know, does this putting pressure on a judge, even if the judge hasn't worked through all those steps, you know, is the judge thinking, gee, these could be my folks here in 3 months when all this is over?
That's one of the reasons why I made the argument about what's the difference between a law firm and working for the government. When you're working for the government, and this is true, you're trying to achieve justice. And the goal of the government is sometimes to make hard decisions about whether you should charge a case or not charge a case, whether you should dismiss a case, turning over the kind of evidence you're supposed to turn over. So I think the obligation and the way that you would curry favor with a U.S. attorney's office if you wanted to is by being somebody who's just. I don't know what the answer
but
is.
But this is a huge death penalty case. I mean, it's rare. I mean, I don't even know if this office has had another one in this decade. So it's hard to believe that the office wouldn't care if the judge starts ruling against it all the time or rules for it all the time. I mean, that matters to this office, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, the best response to this is to go back to the Holland case, because that's the case where this court has most comprehensively spelled out what the standard is that should apply here. I mean, loosely talking today and in the briefs, the parties have talked about the appearance of bias or about the appearance of partiality. The standard has more bite than that. And in Holland, there were a couple things that the court said that are really important. The first thing is that the standard isn't an appearance of partiality. The standard is whether a reasonable person would perceive a significant risk that the judge will resolve the case on a basis other than the merits. And that reasonable person should not be a hypersensitive or unduly suspicious person, but someone who's well-informed and a thoughtful observer and understands all the relevant facts. Well, that's an important standard to apply here.
And in that circumstance here, then wouldn't someone evaluating then have to look at the reality of what was involved here? You have two Democratic senators, one of whom had a committee. You have local attorneys appointed by the senator to evaluate a candidate. Usually what happens, I assume, is, at least it still does, is that they refer two or three names to the senator and say these would pass muster. The senator then makes a recommendation to the White House. The White House may have an entirely different perspective, may look at entirely different people, as indeed is going on right now with respect to our own court. and it may be a different party, as it was in this case. So to some degree, the role of the committee, it could be great, it could be small, it could be nothing. We just don't know. But for purposes of a reasonable evaluator, a reasonable person, should that person take into account the reality of the way the committees work?
Absolutely. That's what the Holland Standard requires. Somebody who's not hypersensitive, but also someone who understands all the relevant facts and is well-informed and has examined the record and the law.
What should we make of the issue that if there's a financial requirement to recuse oneself, which is an absolute standard, the judge can sell the stock, for example, and cleanse him or herself of the taint. Is this the same kind of thing where when the judge said, you know, you've got this motion here, I'm done, I'm not going any farther. Is that the same kind of thing?
I think it is. The argument that we made in the brief is that there's no statutory provision that actually says you can.
But if you had the stock, you have to sell it at the beginning of the case. You can't sell it at the end of the case and get rid of the taint from the whole case while you had the stock, can you? I think this analogy to the stocks is very odd.
No, I think actually what the statute says is if the court has put in a significant amount of time on a case, that's when the court can divest. I'll have to look back at the statute, but I think that one of the standards is whether or not there's been a significant amount of time devoted to the case at that point.
But if you've had the stock and you've been making discretionary rulings all along while you have the stock, and then at the end of the case you get rid of the stock after you've made all these rulings, how do you solve the problem of whether you were trying to help the company with the stock in the course of the case?
Well, that's not the facts of this case. The facts of the case are that there was no contact at all, and I don't think anybody disputes this, until sometime in the middle of December. And so anything that happened up until that point would not be tainted at all.
Right, okay. But there were rulings between when he first started applying and when he withdrew his application.
There were rulings. And there are a couple ways to address that. First, to get back to the 455B argument, 455B does allow you to divest once it comes to
attention. But the divestiture must occur at the time that you discover it. I think what that provision goes to is whether inadvertent discovery. That is, the judge didn't realize that IBM had an interest in the outcome of this. They were not a party, and that he owned IBM stock. And at that point, once he realizes it, then he's got an obligation to do so. But he need not recuse himself from the entire case if he has devoted sufficient time to it. But it's not like he gets to say, well, I own IBM stock. Nobody says anything. And a couple of weeks later, somebody objects and he says, well, now I'm going to divest myself of the stock.
Right. But the difference between 455B and 455A is 455F, which specifically allows a judge to disclose on the record the basis for a potential disqualification and gives the parties the opportunity to waive that. Now, we've argued that there was both an implied waiver by continuing on with the case, but also there was an express waiver of that because when the defendants finally filed their motion on January 29th, they only asked for prospective relief at that point. In fact, even in McKell's new trial motion at the end of the entire trial, he only asked for recusal from the death penalty, mistrial of the death penalty.
So, but you do concede they have an argument as to the penalty phase that is not waived. You might say it's untimely, but it's not waived.
Exactly. I think the waiver would.
So how does this tie in, though, with the question that Judge Bybee asked earlier about if we had to vacate the penalty phase, do we have to do the whole trial again, or can we have a new penalty phase?
No, I don't think so. If the court wants further briefing on that, I'll do it. On the fly, what I recall from 3595 is that, or maybe it's 3593, under normal circumstances, the same jury that hears the guilt phase has to hear the penalty phase. But for good cause, you can bring in another jury.
For the penalty phase only.
I mean, I don't even think we get there on the recusal issue at all.
It's a question, if there's any problem with the penalty phase here, it would be helpful, I think, to know whether they can redo the penalty phase or not.
I think so, and I think that there's nothing in the Federal Death Penalty Act that prevents that because of that specific provision. I'm not certain that's exactly what it says, but I think for good cause, a new jury can be used to try the case.
Under 455E, So this is the provision that says, I'm looking at the second sentence, where the ground for disqualification arises only under A, which is the discretionary recusal provision. Waiver may be accepted provided it is preceded by a full disclosure on the record of the basis for disqualification.
I was wrong. I said 455F. That's the provision I was talking about.
Yeah, so that's E. So if you're disqualified under B, it's mandatory and it doesn't matter whether you get waiver.
Right.
If it's under A, which is the prudential recusal, you can get waiver.
That's right.
Now, was there a waiver here?
I think so.
As opposed to forfeiture?
No, I think what the Rogers case says is that you actually waive the claim, and it's not reviewed for plain error. And I can actually distinguish some of the other cases where we do review for plain error. Most of those, like Rangel, Holland, Bosch, and Bayless, these are the ones that were cited in the defendant's brief. The review was for plain error in those cases. It's not clearly spelled out why. None of them discusses Rogers, and none of them actually discusses.
So what makes it waiver here?
What makes it waiver is a conscious decision to go forward with the trial proceedings, knowing that what the basis for the motion is. And I think it's an analysis that's closely tied with the timeliness of the motion, and some of the same concerns underlie both of them. But the idea is, at least as the Rogers case explains it, if you go forward knowing what the basis is, you can't cry foul afterwards. This is deemed an implied waiver. And that's, I think, what the full disclosure is all about. And I don't have any further arguments to make about whether the disclosure was full.
What about the defense argument that they didn't know the full extent of the judge's involvement there? They didn't know whether he submitted an application. They didn't know any of the things that they learned later on. Does that make a difference in our analysis?
No. There was a full disclosure. The disclosure was the only material thing the defense needed to know to file the motion, which was that the judge had been approached by a screening committee, and he had said, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. It was clearly implied that he was going to send his application in to the screening committee. They filed their motion before they learned anything else about what the judge had done, whether he'd been interviewed, whether he'd been contacted by the DOJ. The only fact that they learned between December 28th and January 29th is that a newspaper had reported some gossip about the fact that he might be a front runner. That doesn't make any material difference about whether there was a basis for the
Does it make any difference that he was going to retire from the bench after this trial?
Well, it does in a couple senses. If I just may insert one argument before I get to that. You know, I was thinking about this while the argument was going on. If the argument is that there was the defense didn't really have a recusal motion until they learned that the judge was a front runner, then anything that happened during the guilt phase is off the table because they didn't find that out until after the guilt phase verdict. And it occurred to me that if that's really what the argument is that they're making, then that takes the entire guilt phase off the table. But the judge was retiring. There are four facts here, I think, that are really, really important. That's one of them. The judge was going to retire anyway. He was supposedly going to go to ADR, and this opportunity came along. He was retiring after, 30 years on the bench. He wasn't going to get paid at all. Unlike any of the other cases that the defense has cited, this judge disclosed on the record exactly what the basis for the recusal was. And then, the timing of his withdrawal of his application is incredible. The motion is filed on January 29th in the evening. The next morning, the judge comes in. He goes, look, I made the call. I withdrew my application. Those facts combined, I think, couldn't lead a reasonably objective observer to believe that this judge, there was a substantial risk that this judge was going to decide issues on other than the merits.
In evaluating this issue, do we need to consider the rulings of the judge from the time that he applied till the time he decided he wasn't going to move forward in order to determine whether there was, in quotes, damage done or harm done?
I don't think so because, as we argued in the brief, we think that the defendants have both waived that argument and filed an untimely motion, so any of those rulings shouldn't be considered. But even if the court does consider them, the rulings, as we've argued throughout the brief, are fairly even. One that I had just sort of scribbled down on my notes was, in leading up to the penalty phase trial, The judge made some rulings about both mitigating evidence and the government's victim impact evidence and also other evidence having to do with uncharged crimes. Judge Bybee, by the way, just to correct one thing, I don't think any evidence about the Turkey and Cyprus murders actually got into the death penalty. It was only that assault of Armin Gürtel.
Why wouldn't a reasonable observer think that this judge who wanted this job in the prosecutor's office would be mad at the defense for making the motion that then made him actually withdraw?
Well, I think the biggest piece of evidence that he wasn't mad is that he withdrew the application right away. And also, I think that there was no – look, he wasn't very far along in the process. He had already had other plans about what he was going to do. He was – and he's now at JAMS.
He could have just said no in the first place. He wanted this job, or he would have said no in the first place. So at least at some level of desire, he wanted this job. And then he basically figures out he's got to withdraw from this application because of the defense motion.
Well,
so why doesn't that look like a problem?
I think you're caught between a rock and a hard place on that one. If you think that that shows evidence that he wanted the job really badly, his withdrawal of it, I think, shows that he was willing to give that up and do justice. And he knew what the case demanded. He let the parties make a decision, and probably the best piece of evidence that a reasonably objective observer would not think that the judge was going to make decisions that were on other than the merits is the fact that the defendants waited so long to file their motion. They waited through the jury instructions. They waited through the jury verdict. They waited through the case in chief that the government presented at the penalty phase before they made the entire case in chief. They got a whole preview of the case, and then they filed the motion. Why shouldn't we use the defendant's own counsel as a reasonably objective observer in this case? Your Honors, if there are no other questions on recusal, then I guess where should we go next? I think I'd like to talk about Mr. Katimovas' claim under too late. Is that appropriate?
Sure.
Okay. There are a couple things that I want to note is the way we argue too late in the brief is to say that there has to be a confession and also some very, very seriously directly implicating statements that are made. And I believe that footnote 3 of too late requires there to be a confession. That's where too late looks back at Bruton and it says, look, the mere fact that it's hard for a juror to apply evidence against one party and not against another party cannot be the basis for Bruton. It has to be that there's something that makes it so difficult for the juror to ignore the evidence, and that's the confession. And so that's why I think too late really does require a confession. But even if we look at too late as a case that just says there have to be some really egregious circumstances where we say we are not going to honor our normal rule, which is that jury instructions normally are going to be followed by the jury. There's a presumption that juries are going to follow the instructions, and there's a presumption that they will ignore the evidence if we tell them. And unless there's something really egregious and we believe the jury can't unring the bell, then we're going to do that. And so I think too late needs something really, really, really bad. And what the government argued in its brief is that McKell never confessed, so that entire aspect of the Bruton, the sort of rationale for too late, isn't even there. There's no reason why they would necessarily believe McKell. And then the other prong of that is that he didn't really say anything that implicated Katimovas. Now, the defense has claimed, well, you know, he sort of suggested that Katimovas was involved in some ways in other kinds of crimes and other sort of international money laundering crimes. But he didn't implicate Katimovas in this crime. He did the opposite. He repeatedly provided alibis for Katimovas. The zip ties, where did those come from? Well, we had the aquarium business. And also, sometimes we would wrap our money in that. Okay, trip to Jamaica. Well, Katimovas was there, but he was working on the aquarium at the hotel that I bought. Katimovas wasn't even there for the Umansky abduction. That's the testimony that McKell gave. It didn't implicate Katimovas at all. And I think that McKell's statements wouldn't even qualify as Bruton. And so they couldn't qualify under too late as error in this case. I filed a 28-J letter a couple days ago citing a case called Angwin, and Angwin has some facts that are very similar to this. Two co-defendants, it's an alien smuggling case. The defendant, Angwin, is claiming duress because they're driving a motorhome up to the border, and he stops to walk his dog, and he claims that a man came up and at knife point forced the aliens to get into the truck. His co-defendant gave testimony that she saw him during the stop off to one side of the motorhome speaking with an unidentified man, at which point Angwin, the defendant, asked her to get back into the motorhome to sit into the passenger seat and not to say anything. And this court held that those statements were not expressly, clearly, or powerfully incriminating of Angwin as required by Bruton. And it said, a statement is not facially incriminating merely because it identifies a defendant. It has to be sufficiently devastating or powerfully incriminating, powerful inculpatory impact to incriminate on its face. And that's what Bruton requires, incrimination on its face. Mikkel's testimony did not incriminate Kadamovas on its face.
And I take it from your 28J letter that you would have us decided on that ground, and at least as to the penalty phase, not on the ground that the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply at all.
As to the penalty phase, yes, of course. I also responded to Mr. Coleman's 28J letter. I think that the circuits who have looked at the issue have all agreed that the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply at the penalty phase. There seems to be an open question about whether it applies to the statutory aggravating factors at all. The argument in the 28J letter is that even if Mikkel's testimony came in and was considered at all erroneously by the jury at the penalty phase, it was not with respect to the statutory aggravating factors. It could only have been to the non-statutory aggravating factors, and therefore there would be no confrontation violation at the penalty phase. But again, I think that it's spelled out a little bit more in the 28J letter. It's a somewhat complicated issue. If the court wants further briefing on that, I'm more than happy to do supplemental briefing. In fact, I suggested in the letter that if the court isn't satisfied with the arguments today, that we do that.
Could you talk about the verdict form?
Yes. I also submitted a 28-J letter on the verdict form. I'm sorry about the flurry of letters at the end. As you bear down on these issues, things come up that maybe you hadn't considered before. The Umania case is about as close on point as you can get. In Umania, they were looking at a verdict form and not jury instructions, but the verdict form had almost the identical language. The language of the jury instructions.
The issue that was argued, though, was it exactly the same? I mean, here I take it that they are arguing that what the judge essentially instructed the jury and then also had on the verdict form was basically telling them to infer that if you met any of these criteria, you were dangerous. And they're saying, we had evidence that wasn't true, and we don't think the judge should have been giving that instruction to infer that. I don't really read Umana as exactly arguing that. It's more like who had to decide what under which prong and how did it, whether it had to be unanimous.
No, what Umania actually ruled was a reasonable juror would have understood the words in the special jury instruction as evidenced by, as references to the alleged bases on which it was permitted to infer future dangerousness. That is, as reference to the government's evidence only, and it wasn't a permissive instruction and it didn't allow that or marshal the evidence in that direction. And it said this was especially so because the same as evidenced by language was used in other instructions. Oh, I'm sorry. This was especially so because the court there said that the instruction was to identify the grounds that the government had put into the notice, the death penalty notice. Real quickly on future dangerousness. Look, the case is Warren, Hauser, Rubio Villarreal. All these cases are explicit permissive instructions. These are cases in Rubio Villarreal. You can infer from the fact that the defendant was driving a car and drugs were concealed in the car that he knew the drugs were in the car. That was what the instruction said. Warren and Hauser said you can infer malice aforethought from the fact that the defendant used a deadly weapon during a homicide. In Ramirez, the court explicitly told the jury you cannot infer anything about the government's case from the fact that they didn't put the key witness on. So we're talking about explicit instructions that come out and tell the jury directly how to infer or not to infer things. We have nothing like that here. It's, at best, an ambiguous instruction, and it doesn't directly tell the jury what to do.
Whether we agree with Umana or not, I mean, we have to decide this question whether Umana is right or not, so let's put Umana to the side for a second. Why doesn't this verdict form tell the jury that if he was not showing remorse, that means he's dangerous, and you should. And I, as the judge, am telling you that there's a logical connection.
Well, I think what the jury verdict form says is you are permitted to consider only the non-statutory aggravating factors specifically claimed by the government and listed below. You must not consider any other facts in aggravation. Now, remember, at the death penalty stage, the government has to put in its notice all of the factors that it's going to use in aggravation and can only put on evidence of those factors. And if it tries to put on any other evidence, that's error. So in this case, the judge had to instruct the jurors about exactly what the government was alleging. And then special verdict form, I think, you know, made it pretty obvious that the judge wasn't asking. I see I'm out of time. Can I finish my answer?
Yes.
All right. I think the special verdict form and the trial proceedings as a whole also made it very clear to the jury that the judge wasn't telling them that they could infer that future dangerousness was proven if the government put on evidence of these facts. So the special verdict form said that the subparts in that instruction and subparts on the form merely describe the government's allegation of how the existence of non-statutory aggravating factors would be demonstrated. Okay? And the judge also told them the government always has the burden beyond a reasonable doubt. You were the only ones.
I guess I just don't understand how you don't read that if you're the jury and think, okay, they have to show these allegations, but if I believe they showed the allegation of lack of remorse or either of the other two, I'm supposed to find that that means they're dangerous as a matter of law, because otherwise why is it in the instructions and why is it on the verdict form this way?
Again, unlike Warren and Hauser, it's not an explicit instruction, even if this court found it ambiguous. That Warren and Hauser tell you have to consider the entire trial, all the jury instructions, all the evidence that's out there to try to figure out what a reasonable juror would have inferred from the instruction and how they would have understood it. I think the most important evidence that shows that the jury could not have understood the instruction to mean what the court just suggested is that substantial time at the trial was devoted to the testimony of people like Dr. Cunningham, who specifically said you cannot infer from lack of remorse.
But that's exactly why I'm concerned about this. So if there hadn't been such testimony, then maybe it wouldn't be contested and maybe these things would automatically be inferable. But in fact, these were contested, and yet then they're listed as if they're as if it's not contested that whether these factors are met means you're dangerous.
But that's what Warren and Hauser tell you to do, is look at all of the facts. Just because the instruction might be ambiguous, no reasonable juror would think, we just spent 2 days listening to Dr. Cunningham and this was a farce. And I'll give you a couple cases on this. But before I do that, I want to say, you know, one of the arguments that the defense counsel made is, look, we're only going to challenge one aggravating factor. This is Katimovas' counsel. That's on GER 6677. And then he said, it's because of this allegation, future dangerousness, that Mark Cunningham testified. And he addressed the three contentions that the government makes. The government didn't call any witnesses. There's not enough evidence. That was the argument that he made. And then the two cases that I want the court to look at are Boyd versus California, where the Supreme Court said it was unlikely that reasonable jurors would believe that the court's instructions, even if ambiguous, transformed all of the defendant's favorable testimony into a virtual charade, which is essentially what would be required here. And then Sims versus Brown, which in a similar context said, finally, and most importantly, for the jury to have believed it could not consider Sims' mitigating evidence, it would have had to believe that Dr. Vickery, this is another case where he testified, that he had conducted an extensive examination of Sims and that Sims' mother, his sister, his stepbrother, and his wife came out to California to testify for naught. Those cases are directly on point. And what they tell the court is no reasonable juror could have assumed that they wasted 2 days of trial if the judge was just going to tell you in the jury instructions, just ignore Cunningham because the government put the evidence on.
Well, they had 3 days of McKell that they were told to ignore.
No, but that's a different question entirely.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, there are a lot of things that happened in this five-month trial that, I mean.
No, but, and I would ask the court to consider the instructions that were given on McKell's testimony. And I'll end there. The instructions on McKell's testimony are way different from the jury instructions here. You are instructed that no one is that McKell is deemed to not have testified. No one testified in this case. You may not consider that testimony with respect to either McKell or Kadamovas. And that instruction, as opposed to this ambiguous instruction, You know, even if the court thought it was ambiguous, I think Sims and Boyd show that the no reasonable jury could have been misled by.
So if we disagree with you, I don't think you argued harmlessness on this issue either. Is that right, or did you?
I'm not sure whether we did. I thought that there was harmless error. Oh no, we did not on this one, Your Honor. So and then what I would say as far as the harmlessness goes is the standard is in Rubio v. Real, and the standard there is is reversal. Reversal is required only if there's no reasonable possibility that the jury instructions require reversal unless there is no reasonable possibility that the error materially affected the verdict. In other words, was there harmless error? And in this case, that's one of the reasons why I talked about the prosecutor's argument on future dangerousness. First of all, I think the evidence clearly does support the inference. This wasn't a close call. These are two defendants that tried to escape from prison, and the prison escape plan involved potentially blowing up the visiting room and maybe killing somebody on the way out. These were, two defendants who had brutally killed five people. They didn't care about their families. They didn't care about the trauma that they were going to put people through, the victims themselves. Remember Rita Peckler? She said that she was pregnant. They didn't care about that, and they killed her after luring her back to their house for the sole purpose of trying to get to Safia. I mean, these were bloodthirsty criminals, and I don't think that any jury would not have found future dangerousness under the circumstances. And so there's no harmless error, even if the court finds that the jury instruction somehow ambiguously was permissive.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'm going to give you each 5 minutes. We have heard extensive arguments this morning. We're going to start with 5 minutes, see where that gets us. But I will ask you to be considerate of the court's time on this one. Now we've been quite generous up front.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just a couple of quick broad points. This court can certainly reverse the death sentence and affirm the convictions. It happens all the time. So there's been some discussion about whether.
Could the penalty phase be redone, though?
Yes, it happens all the time. And we can cite cases on that, but this happens quite frequently. So that's not an issue. Let me first talk about the escape conviction. And I just want to talk about harmless error as to that. The government's first position is it was harmless as to the convictions. But then when I heard their recitation of the evidence, they basically said that, well, the way Mr. Katimovas' cell was where it was located and how he relocated. Well, that may be a piece of evidence. It's an inferential, circumstantial argument they can make, but it's not particularly weighty. They mentioned Avila, which we've discussed, that we have a claim as to Avila's testimony, and he's a cooperating witness. And then the third thing was the money on the books, which I think Your Honor's questions, which is what we had pointed out in our papers, that doesn't really show anything. In fact, it probably shows the exact opposite. So the evidence is extraordinarily weak as to Mr. Katimovas as to the escape conviction. And by the way, he had mentioned the cell location, but then he also conceded there was absolutely nothing in his cell. There was no hole in his cell, no tools in his cell, nothing. If the escape conviction goes, then we get to a harmless error. Now, we didn't hear anything about Johnson versus Mississippi today from the government, so I don't know what their position is on that. They haven't articulated it in the briefs. Their position that somehow the FDPA is different and this court can't accept a waiver of harmless error from the government, they've cited no case law to that effect. I'm happy to brief it later, but we've heard this for the first time today, and I don't see any reason why it would be different in the FDPA context. In fact, you would think that you'd be more likely to hold the waiver against the government in this context. But in any event, what I do want to say, and that leads me into the recusal issue, is waiver.
Well, wait, could we continue on that? Because I think their last argument was that the future dangerousness wasn't an issue here, and I'd like you to respond to that.
Yes, and I thank you, because I did forget that. All these issues are related, and the future dangerous and the lack of remorse are related, and on that verdict form, that in the jury instructions, as we've been discussing, lack of remorse is a major factor for future dangerousness. And what the government said throughout its penalty phase closings is, the one thing I want you to put at the forefront of your mind is lack of remorse. And they showed lack of remorse because they escaped, they would try to escape from custody. It's all related. And, of course, escape is related to future danger. All of these things are related.
But he says that they told the jury not to worry about future dangerousness. Do you have a response to
that? Yeah, the response is they also told the jury the thing to put at your forefront of your mind is lack of remorse. And the reason why they showed lack of remorse, why there was a lack of remorse, is because they tried to escape.
Oh, that seems to me that the lack of remorse argument was far broader than just that they tried to escape.
Well, the way they're justifying it now so that it didn't violate the Fifth Amendment is that we were just basing it on their post-offense conduct that they tried to escape, not that they failed to confess or do these other things. That's their position, and they did specifically reference the escape as showing lack of remorse. And that's tied to future danger. And future danger is a critical factor in the death penalty analysis, as the studies have all shown and the case law shows. So it was certainly a very important factor in the summations and in the penalty phase closings. And the government just said the one aggravating factor that Mr. Katimovas was contesting was future dangerousness. That's where he put his defense. I'm not going to be a future danger. I have no prior record. You know, I have been, you know, other than this escape thing, there's been no incidents, and there still have been no incidents. And the Supreme Court has recognized that future danger, it's a speculative inquiry, and juries often get it wrong. So it's an important factor in the case. As far as recusal, and this gets back to waiver, I mean, waiver goes both ways. So the government, they're saying that they shouldn't be held accountable for their waivers, but only the defense should be held accountable for waiving the recusal issue. No court, first of all, they conceded in their brief that the claim is preserved and not waived as to the penalty phase. And that's all I really want to focus on and care about at this point is the penalty phase. They've conceded that it is not waived. Now, they have conceded also that it wasn't forfeited. Now, there may be an issue as to whether it was timely when you look at the merits of the issue. That's their position. But it's not forfeited and it's not waived. Again, today, we have not heard anything about advisory opinion number 84. It exists. It's there. There is no response to it from that side. That is the governing advisory opinion that governs the federal judiciary. And what it says is, in this context, Judge Trevisan was required to recuse himself.
Well, it's 84 deals with a private law firm.
No, then it says we don't. It says it doesn't just mean a private law firm. It means any future employer. It specifically, the language in the opinion says it's not limited to a private law firm. It specifically says that.
Does it say anything about government employment?
It doesn't. It just says any employer. It doesn't say government or anything. But, I mean, how many, have a general counsel,
Means then that if you're looking at going from the district court to the court of appeals, you would have to recuse yourself from all cases involving the United States.
Well, no, because 84 applies to post-retirement when you're leaving the bench. That's what the opinion is designed to. 84 does not apply to judicial elevation.
Why wouldn't it?
Because it's an entirely different
context. Why is retirement from the bench different as opposed to just getting another job? Let's suppose that Judge Trevisan was not planning on retiring at the end of this case. Do you think he'd be making any different argument here?
It's not retirement. You're leaving the bench.
Mr. Coleman, if Judge Trevisan were not planning on retiring but had the option of taking another position to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, you surely wouldn't come in here and tell us that 84 didn't apply.
No. I don't mean just simply retirement. It means leaving the bench. In order to take another job, you have to leave the bench.
Right.
That goes
then to Judge Trevisan's examples of all of the people who have gone into the executive branch, taken positions with the FBI, become attorney general.
Right, and they're not presiding over they've never cited one.
But it would require, under your theory, it would then require them to recuse themselves in all cases involving the United States.
And there may be an argument to that effect. I don't think we have to go there. We're talking about the very litigation prosecutorial agency that's litigating the case in front of you. I don't think we have to go to every single imaginary, federal position.
The problem where your analogy breaks down is the U.S. Attorney's Office is not hiring him. He's not applying. He's not audit. He's not auditioning for a position as the criminal section chief, where he'd be hired by the U.S. Attorney. He's auditioning, if he's auditioning at all, for an appointment by the president with Senate confirmation. It's a very different thing. And if you're going to go that far, then I think the only conclusion you can say is that he was obligated to recuse himself from all cases involving the United States, including this case.
Well,
it certainly gets you home.
Well, I guess they're different hypotheticals. I mean, if the judge was going to become the head of the FBI, let's say, potentially, and the FBI had a specific case in front of him, well, then maybe he's got to recuse himself from that case. Now, he may not have to recuse himself from an immigration case or something else, but when you're talking about the very agency, the very office that you're seeking to head, and that office has a case in front of you, I mean, I don't think the court has to go down all these other hypotheticals. They're different situations. I mean, he's trying to head this very office. He's going to pull a plug on a death penalty case and then walk into that office in 2 months and say, here I am, everybody, remember me? How is he going to do that? He would never want to do that. Let me think. I know I'm out of time, I think. So finally, on the future danger instruction, Your Honor, we agree with your analysis, or at least what you've said about Umana. It's a different situation. These cases that they're citing that you have to look at all the jury instructions, all those permissive inference cases say that the curative effect of the other instructions has to be included right within the instruction itself. You can't just look at all the instructions as a whole. So, and again, the future danger issue is incredibly important in this case. This court can reverse the penalty for all these reasons and maintain the convictions. And it's a cumulative error analysis. We've made that argument. So I know sometimes we go one issue by one issue by one issue, but you can look at the errors together and say that the penalty in this case should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Tanaka?
I know we're all hungry, so I'll try to be really short. With respect to the Batson issue, I'd like to address Judge Friedland's question. Snyder involved plain error where the court reaches a stage and completes the step three determination.
But how do we know that? Because the judge just basically says objection denied or something to that effect, which is sort of the same thing that happened here.
Well, the court says that it's plain error where the judge has made that determination. And all the cases we cited in our briefs, specifically in the reply brief at page 57, show that where the judge just denies it without comment, that is not the kind of comprehensive, sensitive evaluation that needs to be done. That has one other implication for this case that we haven't talked about a lot, but and that is the prima facie case here was the court said all the defense counsel said struck all jurors, but really it was only 11 out of 13, which is obviously still prima facie case. That was the fact that raised the inference of discrimination. So that doesn't go to just juror 285. That goes to all 11 jurors. Had the district judge completed his duty, we would have a record as to the prosecutor's reasons on all 11 of those jurors. So it's a little unfair, or the analysis isn't right to just limit it to juror 285. Now, moving on to competency, I actually didn't finish with the two most critical points of my chronology, and that is one, Dr. Vickery at the penalty phase testified that McHale had paranoid delusions of conspiracy that prevented him from cooperating with counsel, that explained his actions in testifying. So that brings it full circle.
He testifies at this at what point?
This is the penalty phase.
Okay. And had he recently examined McHale?
Yes, he had.
Okay.
He examined him right at the same day as the penalty verdict, the guilt verdict, as a matter of fact. Then, and the last piece of this, which is the bow and icing on the cake, which had to trigger a duty on the district court to order a competency evaluate or to have a competency hearing, is at that point, defense counsel says, yes, and I have a question as to his competency, putting it right out there. The district court ignored all of that.
That's not a motion, is it?
It's not a motion. It's a question.
But, it's a question.
But it's still the district court's duty in the last instance.
To correct counsel's error.
To assure that.
To supply counsel's motion, the motion that counsel hasn't made.
Counsel said he had a doubt.
It was so obvious to the district court that he had to do it, even though counsel wasn't willing to do it.
I don't know why counsel didn't stand there for it.
I mean, this is just a problem, Mr. Tanaka, with plain error standards generally, is that, of course, we're going to fault district courts for failing to do what the lawyers should have seen that was obvious.
It is obvious. And in a case where there's, like, room to disagree, then maybe. But here the evidence was overwhelming that there was a serious question as to this man's competence in a death penalty trial for his life. It's not asking too much for the court to take a moment and have a hearing on that, to raise this in a serious way, to have some experts do this and give an opinion, not just, oh, I've been watching him and he looks competent to me. More than that, the Constitution requires it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tanaka. I would like to say this. In my 15 years on the court, I have never seen a longer set of briefs. I realize the court was very indulgent in allowing you to brief this. In talking with the clerk's office, no one in living memory has ever seen the briefing that we have seen in this case. And I would like to compliment all counsel. I think the case was extraordinarily well briefed on all sides. I think it was very well argued today. Your clients are well represented. And we want to thank you for assisting the court. We are adjourned.
All rise.